Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
This will not stand. This will not stand, this aggression against Kuwait.
No, I do mind. The dude minds. This will not stand, you know? This aggression will not stand, man.
President George H.W. Bush is being remembered as a statesman, a gracious politician, and a family man. We're going to look now at another part of his legacy, one that is far more controversial. During his 1988 presidential campaign, Bush and his supporters attacked his opponent, Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis, as soft on crime.
Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison.
Willie Horton went on to commit other violent crimes on one of those weekends. The Marshall Project's Beth Schwartzaffel has written a lot about Willie Horton, the black man named in that political ad. She says as soon as that ad ran, it caught fire.
Something about both the ad itself and also the way that George H.W. Bush hammered away at this story on the stump really sort of captured the public's imagination. And the interesting thing is the ad did not run for very long. Mm-hmm. It only aired for a week or two, but it became the subject of countless news stories. People were just talking about Willie Horton constantly.
And remind us, in Massachusetts at the time, I mean, how controversial was the furlough program?
In fact, furloughs were incredibly uncontroversial, not just in Massachusetts, but really anywhere. When we interviewed Governor Dukakis as part of a story we did about the Willie Horton ad, he reminded us that one of the most liberal furlough programs at the time was in the federal prison system under, you guessed it, President Reagan and Vice President George H.W. Bush.
Mm. So Willie Horton, the man, very quickly evolves into an idea, this idea that if, as a politician, you go out on a limb and you decide to become lenient or soft on crime, you will get burned.
Absolutely. And in fact, even now, as Congress contemplates sentencing reform and other types of federal prison reform with the First Step Act, mm-hmm. you've got senators like Tom Cotton warning somebody's going to get out. We're all going to lose our seats if we vote against this. And that's just clearly a nod to the Willie Horton ad. Ever since then, it's sort of set the stage that if somebody gets out and something bad happens, it's automatically the fault of whoever wrote that policy.
Let's talk about how the Willie Horton ad, what it does to prospects of sentencing reform or other criminal justice reform in the years that followed. I mean, at this point, you know, it's the late 80s. America is entering the worst of the crack epidemic. How does this ad set up the Bush administration's drug policies and approach to law enforcement?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was the 1988 presidential campaign where this ad was a major issue. Mm-hmm. And it was 1989 when George H.W. Bush announced a major policy shift around the war on drugs. You may remember he gave a famous speech in 1989 where he held up a little baggie of crack that agents had supposedly purchased in the park across the street from the White House.
This is crack cocaine.
They actually had lured this drug dealer to that park to buy the drugs from him. He didn't even know where the White House was. But the point is that he went before the nation and he said that crack is a number one public priority, that he was going to allocate $1.5 billion to spending on, and this is a quote, more jails, more courts, more prosecutors. He said, if you sell drugs, you will be caught.
And when you're caught, you will be prosecuted. And once you're convicted, you will do time. Caught, prosecuted, punished.
So this was an announcement of a major federal push to use the criminal justice system as a tool to fight the war on drugs.
You mentioned earlier Senator Tom Cotton's remarks, Senator Cotton of Arkansas. And I'm curious, how else do you see the legacy of the Willie Horton ad playing out today as lawmakers are trying to embark on sentencing reform?
I think the main way you see the Horton ad playing out today is in a deep conservatism, and I mean that with a lowercase c, a reluctance to tackle the length of sentences for violent crime. The political lesson is, if somebody gets out and does something terrible, it's not because sometimes bad things happen, it's because it's your fault, you shouldn't have written that law, and you're not going to get reelected.
Beth Schwartzapfel is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. She joined us via Skype. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Christmas is BYU.
And tonight, a Dover teacher on paid leave as that district investigates an assignment sparking controversy in the community tonight. A video of one group's project shows students singing about the KKK to the tune of Jingle Bells. WMUR's Jessica Moran is in Dover tonight with all the details.
Dover school officials are investigating the circumstances surrounding a video of students in a classroom singing about the KKK and killing black people. We spoke with one of the students involved in that assignment.
I want them to know that it was not our intention to offend anyone. We were simply trying to make a factual reference to the KKK and their history.
A Dover High School student trying to explain the video of him singing about the KKK, burning crosses, and killing black people. He says it was part of a school assignment. Dover High School's 11th grade U.S. history class was learning about the Reconstruction era after the Civil War. The student says he was assigned a project involving Jingle Bells and the KKK.
We were just trying to bring to light the terrible history of the KKK and about what they did to, well, just people throughout all of history.
In a portion of the video, you can hear students laughing. The student we spoke with said the laughter wasn't about the contents of the song, but about the strange situation surrounding the class project. More than one student involved said the teacher told them not to record the projects, but one did just that, saying she was offended.
Ignorance, it's very rampant here, and I think people just need to learn how to address these things better. And, you know, I don't want any, like, ill intent on the student. I know the kid, and he's a good kid, so. But I think the way he presented that information was totally wrong. And I said it. I had to walk out because I was so frustrated.
School officials are investigating and determining if anyone involved should be disciplined.
This is definitely not the culture or climate that we want in a school. We want a place where all students feel safe, feel accepted, and are honored for who they are and what they bring to scenarios.
Superintendent Harbron says the principal has already met with the students in that classroom, and they are currently planning on how to meet with the rest of the students. In Dover, Jessica Moran, WMUR, News 9.
I was the first, one of the first. My first day was state trooper coming, putting me in the back seat of the car, and meeting the other black kids with six of us. And then seeing all of those parents and also KKK members having signs and throwing cans at us, spitting at us. We lived in the threat of death every day, every day. So I was just lost in this vacuum between integration and segregation and racism. That was my childhood. I was angry for years. Angry. Very angry.
This is KNKX. Seattle's neighborhoods have become more racially mixed since 1990, but its schools have become more segregated. That's according to a recent study examining the 100 largest cities in the country. More from KNKX youth and education reporter Ashley Gross.
Ryan Coughlin is a sociologist at Gutman Community College in New York. He compared neighborhood demographic data with the racial makeup of public schools. He says Seattle has experienced a dramatic increase in school segregation.
So in 1990, only 3% of the schools in Seattle would have been classified as intensely segregated, meaning that 90% or more of the students in those schools are non-white. Today, that number is up to 17%.
Some possible reasons why Seattle schools are more segregated now. The district gave up on mandatory busing, and the U.S. Supreme Court said the district's effort to integrate by taking race into account in assigning students to schools was unconstitutional. Also, almost a quarter of kids in Seattle go to private school. Ashley Gross, KNKX News.
Black babies cost less.
This week on The Takeaway, we've brought you several stories about health outcomes for Black Americans. We learn why more Black women are dying of cervical cancer in Alabama than anywhere else in the United States, and how stark racial gaps are impacting quality of life and health for African Americans in Wisconsin. Well, today we want to bring you a little bit of good news with a portrait of one community that recognized a problem and decided to fix it. For decades in the city of Sacramento, California, Black infants were dying at twice the rate of other racial groups. But Black infant deaths have decreased significantly in recent years. A new report from the Commission First Five Sacramento says there's been a 45% decrease in Black infant deaths between 2013 and 2016. Chet Hewitt is the president and CEO of the Sierra Health Foundation and co-chair of the Black Child Legacy Campaign, which has been on the front lines of this work. Chet, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tanzia. Great to be here with you today.
Thank you so much. So give us a sense of why were Black babies dying at such a high rate in Sacramento? What did you find?
Well, as a health foundation, we know that many of the causes of the disparities in Black child mortality were really related to four primary causes. And one was a lack of access to health care, or what we would describe as perinatal conditions, infant sleep-related deaths, child abuse and neglect, and third-party homicides. And so as a community, we decided after 20 years of negative reports, this was something that needed to be addressed.
So some of the things that you outline, are those part of a larger picture of lack of insurance, of poverty? You mentioned third-party homicides, child abuse, neglect, access to health care. Tell us a little bit more about that community. What led to those conditions?
Well, like many communities across the country, Sacramento County is dealing with the racial disparities that have roots in issues around poverty and access to quality services. And so we knew that, you know, that was at the root of the challenges that we were facing. The real question was, would we have the political will and determination to really address those issues that are rooted in race and poverty-related issues.
So it sounds like you guys were able to get the political will to do that because you've actually seen some changes. Tell us a little bit about what actually was done. What has the commission done to make this change?
You know, I have to start off by acknowledging who was then a recently elected County Board of Supervisors, Phil Cerner, who received that report that stated that after 20 years, the disparity in a child death and mortality rates of African-American children had never changed, despite decreases in overall death rates for children. And it was at his request that a Blue Ribbon Commission was formed. I was fortunate enough to be part of that particular commission. And one of the recommendations that came out of that was to start a special committee that would take a look at the data we had put together and think about a plan of intervention. And that was simply to say, so what do you do about the knowledge that we now have?
And so what were some of the steps that you put in place, Chet?
Well, one of the things that we started with was to really make this an issue that was owned by the community. It was really surprising that when we released the data that showed that 82% of the preventable child deaths in the four areas I mentioned actually occurred in seven communities. So we not only did we know what the causes of death were, we knew the communities in which they were taking place. And as you stated earlier, these were not our most affluent communities. We also knew that there was clearly a racial dimension to this because of the way that Black children's mortality rates had stood out against all other children over that long period of time. And so the idea was to build real community connection, real community capacity to actually deal with these particular issues, and to have the public institutions that have been grappling with this to take somewhat of a backseat, in some ways to lead from behind, and to allow the kind of authentic community voices and institutions that had been serving this community to really be out front in terms of implementing interventions.
We spoke to one mother. Her name is Tamara Walton, and she participated in Black Mothers United, which is one of the local programs that's providing this type of education and support to Black moms in Sacramento. And she gave us a sense of what her experience was. Let's take a listen.
One of the best memories I have is we had a yoga class. And I was like, I have never done yoga ever in life. What am I going to do? But it was very relaxing afterward. My son was there. He was just a couple months old, but, you know, I was able to have him there. And just to have that connection with other moms, it just kind of made me feel at ease a little bit to know that I wasn't just the only one going through everything that I was going through. There was other women that looked like me that were pregnant or have, you know, had their babies and needed assistance just as much as I did.
Chet, have you heard stories that are similar to what Tamara just described there in terms of accessing yoga and other types of solutions?
Yes, I've had many, many stories like this. And the level of support to bring yoga to communities that often don't see that type of service and to use it within the realm of promoting health and well-being is part of what's led to such dramatic decreases. And as you said, we've seen all infant death rates for Black children decrease by 45%. But what's even more amazing in many respects, and that's a pretty amazing statistic by itself, is that you've seen a disparity between all other children and Black children decrease as well. And that's decreased by 76%.
That's a pretty significant decrease there, Chet. And I'm assuming you guys have plans for continuing that decrease further.
Yeah, our community is, you know, ecstatic about the results of the interventions. And we believe that we not only have the political will to continue, but clearly the kind of community support that it's going to require to reduce or eliminate the disparity in its entirety.
Chet Hewitt is the president and CEO of the Sierra Health Foundation and the co-chair of the Black Child Legacy Campaign. Thanks for being with us, Chet.
Thank you,
Little brother, I heard y'all ain't hitting in New York. Word. I heard y'all ain't hitting in L.A. Word. Word. I heard y'all ain't hitting in North Carolina.
North Carolina.
A former Cherokee County detention officer was just indicted for the assault of an inmate. Former guard Wesley Killian faces two misdemeanor charges for allegedly kicking an inmate in the face last May. Killian and another guard, Joshua Gunter, were both fired after the incident. And that incident is part of a growing number of allegations of abuse leveled at Cherokee County Detention Center. There are several SBI investigations underway. The most recent involves a report of a naked inmate chained to a drain in his holding cell. Investigative journalist Kate Martin is part of a team at Carolina Public Press investigating alleged abuses at the jail, and she joins us now. Welcome back, Kate.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
Tell us about this latest indictment at the Cherokee County Jail, the detention center.
Right. The indictment came down on Monday. A grand jury decided that this jail guard, Wesley Killian, should be indicted for two misdemeanors. Basically, one is assault with a deadly weapon because he kicked the inmate in the face while the inmate was chained. The other is, you know, essentially doing bodily harm. And so he's facing these two very serious misdemeanors.
When did these allegations and when did the alleged assault take place?
The assault took place on May 2nd of this year.
Mm. Any more indictments expected?
You know, not that I know of. I don't think so. I think the other guard actually talked to me and told me that he wasn't facing charges.
All right. So now this is one of a number of allegations. You reported recently on an allegation involving an inmate being chained in his holding cell. Tell us more about that.
So I got a tip from a reader that an email existed regarding this incident. And apparently what happened is a deputy who had been, I think he was a patrol deputy, had come into the jail, had heard all this commotion. This guy was yelling for help. And he asked what was going on. And he was told that there was an inmate chained to the floor, like a grate in the floor, and he was naked. And so he kind of went about his business, came back about 6 or 7 hours later, and the guy was still there naked, chained to the grate. And he was worried that the inmate couldn't use the restroom, and he wasn't sure if what was going on was legal or illegal. So he sent an email both to the sheriff and to a man named Mark Thigpen, who is the chief deputy.
Now, this is interesting because when did this all happen? A while ago?
Yeah, the incident with the naked inmate happened last year, like July 7th and 8th.
And so what's interesting about that is that the deputy sent an email
yes.
to both the sheriff and the detention center uh-huh. chief saying, look, this is going on. You need to know about this. The sheriff has said recently about a number of allegations surrounding this detention center that he was unaware of all of this.
Right. He said in a radio interview prior to our story running about the naked inmate that he didn't know of allegations of, you know, impropriety or inmate abuse. You know, deputies didn't come and talk to him. Well, actually, this one deputy did talk to him. He did alert him to this incident.
And you've got the email traffic to show that.
I do, so yeah.
Talk about this deputy, too, because he's upset about all of this.
Well, you know, so there's two different incidents here. We've got the naked inmate, which happened last year, and then we've got the other incident with the assault, which are two separate incidents. The one with the assault, one of the deputies, Killian, was indicted. The other one, his name's Joshua Gunter, was not. And Gunter's the one who talked to me about the assault on the inmate, which has nothing to do with the naked inmate.
Right, right.
He actually told me he was offered his job back about a week and a half ago. And he said that he declined to take the job. He said, I turned it down because I won't work under that sheriff. That man puts his ego above his morals. He also said, and just to keep in mind, Derek Palmer, the sheriff, is a former pastor, and my understanding is he still does some of that work. He said, Gunter said about the sheriff, he's a coward that hides behind a badge and a man who hides his sins under his Bible.
Now, this is in amidst a growing number of allegations about improprieties at this detention center. The SBI is investigating, right?
Well, I do know the SBI has been asked to investigate. The latest request from the sheriff and the district attorney, Ashley Welsh, up there is that the SBI investigate all incidents from December 1st, 2014 until present, which is essentially the first term of the sheriff's first term. And I don't know how many SBI investigators it would take to do 4 years worth of work, but I imagine it's more than what they have in that area. I'm still trying to figure out what that's about.
Right, because we've talked about two incidents that are now public, the assault indictments and then the allegations of a inmate being chained, a detainee being chained naked in his detention center. But you have been receiving a number of tips since you first began reporting.
Yeah, definitely. Stay tuned. We've got a lot of tips. One thing I do want to bring up is how important this type of reporting is. You know, they do have a radio station and a newspaper out there. But I mean, as anybody who's worked in rural news, you know that you're strapped for resources. I did get an email from one of the relatives of the inmate who had been chained to the grate, who he has since died. And she was really distraught. She said that if it weren't for our reporting, they would never know that this had even happened.
Right. And for people who have these tips, they don't know where to go. And if it's the sheriff in a small county like that, you're not going to mess around, right? Mm-hmm. Unless you know that maybe there's a way that you can get the word out. So,
yeah.
People
are afraid. People, they give me tips, but they're terrified. They don't want their names used, and I can understand that.
All right, well, keep up the good work. Kate Martin, investigative journalist with Carolina Public Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
I don't want to cause any problems, Lieutenant. I just want a new partner.
Oh, I understand. Your partner's a racist prick, but you don't want to stir up any bad feelings with him.
Well, he's been on the force for a long time.
And, 17 years.
And I do have to work here, sir.
So, you don't mind that there's a racist prick on the force. You just don't want him to ride in your car.
If you need me to go on record about this, sir, I will.
That'd be great. Write a full report. Because I'm anxious to understand how an obvious bigot could have gone undetected in this department for 17 years, 11 of which he was under my personal supervision, which doesn't speak very highly of my managerial skills. But that's not your concern. I can't wait to read it.
North Carolina elected a number of African-American sheriffs in the midterms. Those results include the first African-American female sheriff ever to serve in the state. Part of the blue wave, or a signal that larger progressive counties and other counties around this state want change? Leonita Inge is WUNC's race and Southern culture reporter. She covers the story and spoke with a number of incoming sheriffs. Welcome back, Leonita.
Hi, Frank.
Largest county in the state elected black sheriffs, so that's the place to start. Let's start there because there were other counties as well, but let's start with the big counties.
Well, the big counties, you mentioned the Democratic wave, so that does get part of a lot of the credit. Mm-hmm. I was going to say part of the credit. A lot of the credit because it seems all these African-American sheriffs were Democrats who won, and they were all, I can't say they were all facing Republican Republican challengers, because in Durham County, there was no Republican challenger. So that means, I guess, Clarence Burkhead automatically, he won in the primary. So then he held on to his position. But in really almost all of the other cases, from Wake County to Forsyth and Buncombe and Mecklenburg, there were actually either a white Republican incumbent who literally had served 4 or 5 terms, or it was a white Republican challenger who was going head to head with a black Democratic candidate.
So let's talk about the old regime. Who were these sheriffs? Is there anything, apart from their race that would connect them in terms of how they were running things in the state? Do we know in their counties?
Well, I guess that in a way they were well-liked. I mean, they held their posts a very long time. And when you think about, I guess, sheriffs, you think of sometimes like the big guy in town. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to say Boss Hogg, but, you know, we hear mm-hmm. that terminology. They ran these counties and people, you know, respected them. But over the past several years, there have been instances where the federal government has stepped in, you know, the 287G program, ICE, you know, when county sheriffs had they could decide on their own if they would participate in a program where they would sort of hand over people who lived in their counties who were there illegally. And that just did not sit well with a lot of residents. And I think that also helped in their demise this go-round.
You spoke with newly elected Wake County Sheriff Gerald Baker, who talked about the problems with his department, not necessarily the county, but he was talking about things within the department that apparently tracked and registered with voters.
Internally, we needed some organization, you know, that it lacked on the inside of our sheriff's office. You know, there was some integrity issues, accountability issues, diversity, community involvement, the very things that we, you know, that our platform was based on, were important things that the citizens responded to.
That's a clip from the new sheriff of Wake County, Gerald Baker, and we're talking to WUNC reporter Leonita Inge about the record number of black sheriffs elected in the midterms. Now, predictably, these sheriffs are all saying to the person, this is not, they are not the black sheriff, right? This is what they're telling you.
No, they don't like being known as the black sheriff. I think that has a lot to do with just law enforcement in general. They're like this fraternal group of people who don't want to be recognized for the outside, but the inside and what they bring to the job. But, you know, when you talk to them a little while, they do mention that at the top of their list of things they want to do is to diversify that department. They feel that it's not enough people of color that serve in these sheriff's departments at all.
And maybe something that they were hearing from voters, that representation does matter. Tell us about the first, another first for the state, the first African-American woman sheriff. Tell us more about Paula Dance.
Oh, I like Paula Dance. She's tough. And it's not that just she's tough. She just decided she's a major, you know, in the Pitt County Sheriff's Department. So that she's the highest ranking woman, period. And she said, you know, when a new sheriff comes to town, usually they change their administration. They start kind of firing everybody. And she says, you know, I don't think I'm ready to go. And she just said, I'm just going to run. You know, enough people supported her. She says, I think I can run this department. And she ran and she won.
Let's listen to Paula Dance.
I hope to be a pioneer for other women, because there are lots of women in law enforcement, and we usually get to a certain plateau, and that's it, because nobody really, especially women of color, have never really kind of, well, they've stepped out but haven't won. I ran a very good campaign. I ran off my qualifications and experience. I ask people not to look at my outside, but to look at what I bring to them from the inside.
Right, that's a clip of the new sheriff of Pitt County, Paula Dance, the first African-American female sheriff ever elected in North Carolina. I'm talking to WUNC race and Southern culture reporter Leonita Inge. So nobody wants to be considered the black sheriff. But to what extent do you think this does matter in those counties to see someone who looks like them and is running the sheriff's office?
Oh, it matters a whole lot, especially when you have many people in the African-American community who feel law enforcement officers are out to get them, you know, that they can't even freely walk down the street. They're mistaken for other people who may have done something bad. And I think that has also played a part in maybe the turnover in these departments, especially in the large urban areas where there are a lot of most of the African Americans, I'll say, in this state.
Leonita Inge, WNC's race and Southern culture reporter, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
So what's it like being a black man in the city of Milwaukee?
Black people are actually dying because of living in Wisconsin. And that's unconscionable to me.
By many measures, Wisconsin is one of the worst places for black Americans to live. In the cities of Milwaukee and Racine, black Americans make half of the median income of whites and are 11 times more likely to be incarcerated, according to a report from 24/7 Wall Street.
That investment in African Americans is not there.
Dr. Alex G. is the founder and president of the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development, and he's lived in Madison for decades. And he said it wasn't always this way.
My family moved to Madison in 1970 because my mother was going through a divorce, was a high school dropout her freshman year. But when we showed up in Madison, she was invested in. They asked, what do you want to do? What do you want to become? Long and short of it is, my mom took the GED, took the entrance exam, got her undergraduate degree, paid cash for me and my sister to go to the university, and then she won a full fellowship to grad school. When people who look like my mom come here today, 50 years later, and they're a single mom from Chicago, Chicago is code for gangs. And we have blamed our problems on people from Chicago and Milwaukee and have not noticed that Madison-born African-Americans have not been thriving here for decades.
Despite his mother's success, Dr. G told me the stress of being black in Wisconsin has continued to take its toll.
My family now has 12 degrees from Wisconsin, but we all suffer some stress-related illness from the isolation of living in this community. So even though we're trying to pursue the American dream and live out the Wisconsin idea, through the heights of Wisconsin's black mortality rate, my wife lost two babies during that same time. And so we tend to think that those are uneducated, low-income black moms who don't have fathers, who don't have prenatal care. But yet I can name a half dozen to a dozen professional black women who also lost babies during that same period of time. And they're counted in those numbers. And so the impact of all of this is really horrendous. And we need a serious wake-up call.
In Wisconsin, there's a familiar phrase called the Wisconsin idea. Its origins go back to the early 1900s with University of Wisconsin President Charles Van Hise. He and the governor at the time, Robert La Follette, worked hand in hand focusing the government and the university's resources to usher in an era of prosperity for all families. Wisconsinites know it as their guide for public life, but that progress did not make its way to many of the state's black residents.
For some folks, people are really struggling.
That's Angela Lang, the executive director of Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, or BLOC.
Wisconsin is home to the most incarcerated zip code. Wisconsin is the worst place to raise a black child. Milwaukee and Racine are on lists of greatest racial disparities. It's a struggle out here.
I spoke more with both Lang and Dr. Alex G.
I think it's a very tricky time for being black in America, to be quite honest. I think what makes it increasingly more difficult in Wisconsin is that our state motto is forward. And we have the reputation of being this progressive liberal bastion, sort of, particularly in Madison, the home of the flagship University of Wisconsin-Madison. There's a sense of progression that makes us above the types of challenges that we're experiencing in our state. So what it means in a place like Madison is that we look over our shoulders to the east and think, well, that's Milwaukee, Kenosha, and Racine, but we have things together. We don't see color. We have the university. We have state workers. And so black people are doing well here, right? And I've lived here since 1970. I moved here as a six-year-old. We are anything but liberal.
Right. I mean, and that's why I was going to ask you about your work with incarceration.
Sure.
Because that indicator right there would show the opposite.
Definitely. Well, I remember when I started Nehemiah in the late 80s, I left my job at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So I graduated and I worked there as an admissions officer and as an assistant to our chancellor. In the late 80s, we found that the black population in Madison and Dane County basically doubled from 1980 to 1990. Those of us who are African-American influencers, I'm also the most tenured clergy person in our community. So I've been involved in leading a church for about the last 35 years. We said, hey, our population is growing. What we're noticing is that young people are going to mental health hospitals and juvenile correction facilities at a much faster rate than their white counterparts who are getting community service, first offender programs. We need more social workers, counselors. We need more judges. We need people in the system because Black children are not getting the same shake. No, we're Madison, we're progressive. Oh, Alex, we don't see color. We love everyone. You fast forward to where we are today, where we're leading the nation in the incarceration of Black people.
Angela, I want to turn the conversation a little bit towards political engagement of Blacks in Wisconsin specifically. We saw in 2016, African-American turnout drop by almost 20%. Obama did win the state. Hillary infamously lost the state. What can you tell us about that drop?
Yeah, I think one of my biggest takeaways from the drop is the level of engagement. I think there is a little bit of people just assumed Black folks voted for Obama. Black folks are automatically Democrats. We don't need to talk to them until a couple days before an election. When you had all of these things happening in the media, combined with not being authentically engaged and being engaged in a very transactional way, not just in 2016, but as a whole, I've seen campaigns, I've seen elected officials and candidates only knock doors in October saying, hey, vote for me, I'm going to change your life, never to be seen or heard from again. And so I think with a lot of communities, specifically communities of color and Black folks, is that people aren't here for that. Like, gone are the days where you can just show up the weekend before the election and just expect people to vote for you. You want our vote, come get our vote.
How much do you think segregation and racial animus is really at the root of these issues that we're talking about? You know, Dr. G, there are health discrepancies. Angela, we've talked about the political challenges, the incarceration issues. How much of this is bad policy and how much of it is really segregation at the root of this?
I think they feed each other. You know, it's interesting. The powers that be don't really listen to infected parties, to those who are most touched by these issues. And so one of the things I keep saying is that in 30 years of being a community activist, someone very involved in the community, I'm typically invited to the tables with my other Black colleagues once a policy, a plan, or report, once they've been prepared, and we've been asked to rubber stamp it. And if we say that this does not speak to our issues, we're treated and marginalized as angry people who are simple-minded, and we can never be satisfied. And so that's how things really are played out. Folks in Wisconsin, Black folks are thinking folks. We've got feelings. We've got experiences. We choose to live here. We're not banished here. We choose to live here. But yet, it's so difficult to bring our voices and our perspectives to the table. We've been talking about the stress of isolation, the microaggressions for years. But again, policy leaders aren't necessarily listening to that because they say, well, the unemployment is low. This is a great utopia. It'll be fine. Just work harder. We're now finding that disparities that used to only rear its head in Black and white reading rates and math rates are now becoming social determinants of premature death in Blacks by the same illnesses that our white counterparts have. We're now seeing the phenomenon in Wisconsin of something called racial battle fatigue, where now African-American people, after suffering other kinds of discrepancies, are now being shown to die more quickly and more often of the same illnesses that their white counterparts have. We're leading in most of them, and there's indications that show that it's really due to the microaggressions and the just the sense of isolation and sort of this pending frustration that happens in being in a progressively minded place like Wisconsin that's not responding to its Black population.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Dr. G that policy kind of fuels into and feeds into segregation. Mm-hmm. You know, when we're talking about segregation specifically in Milwaukee, there's literal bridges that divide the North to the South side, the North being predominantly Black, the South side being predominantly Latinx. And there's a bridge. You see the dividing line. You see the neighborhoods physically change. And we can see how many folks are being policed at a higher rate. You know, we spend more, you know, as a state and, you know, also on the municipal level, we spend more on locking up our Black and brown folks than actually educating them. And, you know, how can we have thriving communities where we're not investing in our futures from a very political way and putting our money where our mouth is and being able to invest into thriving communities? And I think that shows that by and large, communities of color are not afforded the opportunity and the freedom to actually thrive because we're not being invested in, but we're being invested into locking up our futures instead of funding our futures.
Angela Lang is the executive director of Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, or BLOC. Angela, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Alex G is founder and president of the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development. Dr. G, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
We turn now to some other North Carolina news. This in the Triad. A few months ago, Marcus Dion Smith was seen pacing the streets of downtown Greensboro, behaving erratically. Police attempted to subdue him and drive him to the hospital, but Marcus continued to evade their efforts. Ultimately, police used a restraint method known as hogtying. A medical examiner's report said that technique contributed to Marcus's death, which has now been ruled a homicide. The police released a video of the incident shortly after the release of the medical examiner's report. Greensboro Police Chief Wayne Scott has since revised the use of the technique, but the incident has left many in the community angry and community leaders looking for answers. Joining us now with an update is Jordan Green, senior editor at the Triad City Beat. Welcome back, Jordan.
Hi, good to be with you, Frank.
Let's talk about the medical examiner's report. It did declare that Marcus Dion Smith's death was a homicide.
That's right. It said the manner of death was a homicide.
All right. And the homicide, to be clear, is not, I mean, when we hear that word, we think of crime, but it's not necessarily a crime. It just means that it came at human hands, that something that humans did caused this death. But whether or not it's a crime is still another level of inquiry, right?
Yeah, that's right. It means somebody died at the hands of another. So there can be justifiable homicides if somebody is acting in self-defense. That would be an example. And I think in this case, the question is whether the officers were acting in good faith to do everything they could to help Marcus Smith.
Well, let's talk about this video, what it shows, and what police did. They were trying to get him to the hospital. He was acting erratically. Tell us more about what we see in the video.
Well, what you see in the video is Mr. Smith had voluntarily gotten into a police car, was sitting in the back, and then he became disturbed and tried to break out the windows and tried to kick out the windows. And so the officers opened the door because they were worried about him breaking the glass. And he kind of rushes forward, and he's intercepted by a police officer, and multiple police officers bring him to the ground. They've already decided that they're going to use the rip hobble, which is a device for hogtying. And they cuff his hands behind his back, and then they take this device and loop it around his ankles and pull it up through the handcuffs. And they spent a little less than a minute applying the restraint, and Mr. Smith is groaning and crying out and very distressed, and then gradually his moans subside, and in the last 20 minutes he's silent, and then an officer asks if he's all right, and he doesn't respond, and they realize that he's unresponsive, and they turn him over on his side and remove the restraint.
And ultimately, as we say, he did die. What is the status of the officers right now?
Well, they are back on regular duty. One of the strange parts of this case is that they were returned to duty and cleared of wrongdoing in the middle of November prior to the autopsy being completed. And to this date, we still don't have the SBI investigative report.
And clearly this technique had something to do with it. That's what the autopsy found. It did contribute to his death. What is Police Chief Wayne Scott saying about that technique?
Well, he hasn't said much publicly. Interestingly, 2 days before the homicide finding came out, he defended its use to me, saying it's safer than the alternative of flexi-cuff. As you noted in the introduction, the day the homicide determination came out, Chief Scott issued a special order discontinuing the use of the rip hobble as a four-point restraint. So that's essentially hog tying. So they're reviewing the policy, but for the time being, they're not going to use this restraint.
I've just got about 10 seconds left. What is Greensboro's mayor saying?
She wants to get to the bottom of why the initial press release was misleading, and she was also proposing to field mental health professionals with the police to try to avoid situations like this in the future.
Jordan Green, senior editor at the Triad City Beat. You can find links to his reporting at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you, Jordan.
Thanks so much, Frank. Take care.
Just ahead, we're going to hear from a member of the UNC Board of Governors who says Silent Sam needs to be back on his pedestal. And we'll hear the counterargument to that.
The Watcher. The Watcher. The Watcher. The Watcher.
You don't usually find companies asking for regulation on the technology that they're developing, but Microsoft is doing just that. The company wants Congress to write laws for its facial recognition technology in 2019. Microsoft is positioning itself as an outspoken elder statesman while still trying to beat its competitors. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports.
For Silicon Valley, this has been a troubled year.
Markets down, and Apple's a big reason why.
It's a wave of walkouts at Google offices around the globe.
Facebook just had what might be the biggest wipeout in stock market history.
And in the midst of it all, this happened.
Microsoft surpassed Apple.
Microsoft has now several times unseated Apple as the world's most valuable company, a designation Microsoft last occupied in the early 2000s. Part of Microsoft's steady rise in the recent years has to do with avoiding crises. The company has been cultivating an image as Silicon Valley's moral compass. It does business with the government while also suing the government. It profits from controversial new technologies while also urging regulation. Here's Microsoft President Brad Smith speaking today at the Brookings Institution.
We've turned down deals because we worried that the technology would be used in ways that would actually put people's rights at risk. You don't want to see the race run by some people who are taking the high road, while others who may just not be thinking enough about these issues.
We should note, Microsoft is one of NPR's sponsors. For a long time, Microsoft was viewed as a stodgy company. After years of struggling with its identity, it's coming into its own, finding its place among the newer tech stars like Google and Amazon. Technologically, Microsoft decided to bet on data stored on the cloud, and cloud computing is paying off big.
They have made a tremendous amount of progress in the last 2 to 3 years of really bringing their product up on par with what Amazon has been offering, and Amazon has been the market leader a lot in the cloud computing space.
Andrew Hunter is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he follows government contracts. Now, much of the government already runs on Windows and Office, but now it's a race to put government data on the cloud and to sell the government modern technologies, including to the Defense Department.
Their profile within the market has really risen in the last couple of years.
In Silicon Valley, this kind of work took on new controversy this year. Amazon faced an outcry for giving its facial recognition technology to law enforcement, raising concerns about surveillance. Google canceled a contract with the Pentagon after employees protested that their artificial intelligence could be used for drone strikes. At Microsoft, CEO Satya Nadella also had to quell dissent over the company's products being used by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. At the same time, Microsoft signed a deal worth almost $500 million with the U.S. Army. It will equip soldiers with augmented reality headsets. Again, Microsoft is trying to walk the middle line. Here's Brad Smith speaking last week at a defense conference.
For us, we've been clear. We are going to provide the U.S. military with access to the best technology, to all the technology we create, full stop.
But then he adds, Microsoft will also be actively involved in setting boundaries for this technology, especially artificial intelligence and autonomous weapons. In today's speech, Smith did just that, laying out a plan to regulate facial recognition. He says if we wait while technology spreads, we could be on our way to Big Brother dystopia. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
About as funny as a lynching.
Oh, hush, boy, you ain't even see it.
I never seen a lynching either, but I know they not funny.
See, shows what you know. I've seen funny lynchings.
No, you haven't.
I have, so. Roscoe Patterson's lynching was funny.
Yeah, so them niggas was like, Roscoe, you better leave time for Mr. Charlie and them crackers gonna fall for you.
I'm like, man, fuck these crackers, man. It's Roscoe Patterson. Nigga, I don't give a fuck. I just don't give a fuck. You know what I'm saying? White man can eat a dick. Eat my bowels, nigga.
There he is. Get that nigga.
Oh.
Hey, I
go. Let's go. Oh, jeez. Watch out.
It wasn't really funny after that.
Mm-mm. Missouri is acknowledging the horrific legacy of lynching in the state with a new historic marker in Kansas City. It's part of a national project toward truth and reconciliation about the aftermath of lynching. Reporting for Sharing America, Michelle Tyrene Johnson of KCUR has the story behind the monument.
On a cold and windy November day in West Terrace Park, overlooking where Bluff Street Bridge used to be in the West Bottoms, the surroundings are very different than they were on April 3, 1882. That was the day that Levi Harrington was lynched. He was married, an African-American father of five, a porter, and a laborer. Harrington's parents had moved their family to Kansas City, most likely to escape the racial horrors of Mississippi after their time as slaves had ended. Newspaper accounts show that Harrington was accused of killing a police officer. Jerry Sanders has researched the case. She's an archivist with the Black Archives of Mid-America.
He was a good man, and he just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. They said he was eating. When the mob came, he looked up, saw the white mob, and he ran. And so they caught him. And you know what happens with the mob is that they just decided that they would just go ahead and lynch whoever they found.
Shortly after Harrington's lynching, the actual culprit was arrested and put on trial. 60 documented lynchings of black men took place in Missouri between 1877 and 1950, the second highest number outside of the South. Levi Harrington will be the first lynching victim in Missouri to be honored. Stacy Pratt is one of the driving forces behind that.
I don't see this simply as a marker for Mr. Harrington, though most profoundly and most sacredly it is, but it's an opportunity for us to gather and to really engage with what's going on in our community now and see how we can change it.
Pratt leads the organization Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. She sees a connection between lynching and the work she does. Pratt says data shows the racial correlation between where lynchings took place in Missouri and where capital punishment takes place now. This project to remember lynching victims goes beyond Kansas City. Organizers received a grant from the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. Earlier this year, EJI opened a memorial museum dedicated to America's lynching victims. At this museum, they keep jars of soil collected from the sites of documented lynchings. Soil from the lynching site of Harrington is there now. Glenn North is a local poet and black culture savant. He believes Harrington's dedication is a start to honoring all the lynching victims. Collecting soil from the lynching sites, he says, helps connect people to the past.
And if you can use those kind of symbols to touch people on an emotional level, I think that's when people start moving beyond that cognitive dissonance or that denial and have to deal with what's currently going on, and hopefully take the necessary steps to move forward.
Jerry Sanders of the Black Archives says the work doesn't end with the Harrington dedication. She is still doing research to find his descendants and hopes to honor the other victims with the Missouri Museum. The dedication included a reading of Glenn North's poem, Lynch Family Blues.
Now I'm walking on air, baby. Feels almost like I'm free. My feet steady kicking the wind. Yeah, I'm close to being free. And for the first time in my life, baby, white folks is looking up to me. Hear me, son. Your daddy loves you. Keep hanging onto hope. You the man of the house now. Gotta help your mama cope. Daddy won't be coming home no more. 'Cause I reached the end of my rope.
In Kansas City, I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson.
Michelle Tyrene Johnson is a reporter at KCUR in Kansas City and part of the Sharing America Collaborative, funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For more Sharing America stories, go to sharingamerica.news.
Carry me back to old Virginia. There's where the cotton and the corn and taters grow. There's where the birds warble sweet in the springtime. There's where the old darkest heart am long to go.
In Charlottesville, Virginia, a jury late yesterday found James Fields, Jr. guilty of first-degree murder. Fields is the Ohio man who drove his car into a crowd of anti-racist protesters at the Unite the Right rally a year ago. One person died, Heather Heyer. Dozens of others were injured. As Hoss Spencer of member station WCBE reports, the guilty verdicts have given the community another chance to heal.
The defendant was motionless as he listened to the word guilty for all 10 charges against him, including the most severe, first-degree murder. Heather Heyer's mother was in the courtroom as the verdicts were announced. Afterwards, a group of activists gathered outside. The Charlottesville rally took place last year after the city voted to remove a Confederate statue from a park. Groups of neo-Nazis and white nationalists protested and were met by hundreds of counter-protesters when the car attack happened. Last night, local resident Tanisha Hudson said the verdicts send a strong message.
Don't think that you can come here and do this type of stuff and get away with it, because we're not having it.
Courtney Commander was among the people who went to oppose the rally with Heather Heyer.
You know, it'll never, like, bring back or undo the things that have happened from that day, but it definitely feels like justice has been served in a sense.
Marcus Martin testified during the trial about having his leg broken when the car crashed into the massive group of people. He was photographed in the famous picture wearing red tennis shoes as he was hurled into the air.
Today I can breathe. Today I think everybody can breathe.
The jury returns next week as the penalty phase begins. Fields could be sentenced to life in prison in this case, but his days in court aren't over. He still faces the possibility of the death penalty on federal hate crime charges. For NPR News, I'm Hawes Spencer in Charlottesville, Virginia.
So, my sister is a vegan. She talks about it all the time because it's important to her, which is fine. It's her choice. I also have a close cousin who is vegan, but he never talks about it at all. To each their own. Because, see, there is a difference between ethical vegans and dietary vegans. Ethical vegans don't wear leather, avoid animal captivity places like zoos and aquariums, etc. Dietary vegans just don't eat things with a heartbeat. And in the UK, this argument might end up in court because a vegan got fired from his job at an animal welfare charity. The argument is that ethical veganism is a protected class and discrimination against it effectively qualifies as a hate crime. Let me explain something. That's insane. What you put in your body to consume in most cases is a choice, allergies aside. As a black person living in America, I can tell you that being vegan is not something that is going to ruin your life. Implying that it's the same as race, religion, or sex is an insult to all humans. Never mind animals. I'm Clinton Whitney Yates, and that's my take.
Okay, we're trying to find victims, because you can't have a victim of something that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, we talked earlier, when you talk about counter-racist logic, in that counter-racist logic is dealing with clearly defined meanings of words.
Yes.
Now, before we get into some of the ones, and I know you're expanding this list as we speak with another book, there are several words that you have a problem with that outline just how effective white supremacy is, and especially in the black community. You don't like that term. Tell us why.
Well, here again, just following the logic. It's not a matter of likes or dislikes. It's a matter of
following the logic. Okay.
Okay.
Protests in Birmingham years ago helped change the nation. The protests over a Hoover police officer's fatal shooting of a young black man at the River Chase Galleria on Thanksgiving have divided the community. While crowds march and vow to shut down the mall with protests, others say wait on the investigation results before deciding what to do. WBHM Cheryl Wheeler-Stewart reports.
Demonstrators have marched inside the mall to the very spot where Emantic Bradford Jr. was killed. They've marched in front of City Hall. Police initially said Bradford fired shots that Thanksgiving night at the River Chase Galleria when he was fatally shot. But they later said the real gunman was still on the loose. They arrested a Bessemer man on Friday in connection with the shooting. In the meantime, protesters continue to feel outraged. Kara McClure is founder of Black Lives Matter Birmingham and participates in the marches. She's heard people say they should wait until after the investigation to march, but she disagrees.
Wait on what? Our protest is based on what we already know. We already know what Hoover Police Department admitted to. They admitted to shooting and murdering EJ, and we know that they lied.
Activists want video of the incident released. And they want Hoover residents to know what it's like to be targeted based on race. But there's another chorus in the community saying the activists should not rush to judgment. Gary Richardson hosts Morning Talk on WJLD, an African-American talk show. He's also mayor of Midfield. He says he encourages the black community to be calm and patient.
We are in a society where people want instantaneous results, you know, like watching TV on the cop shows, and we're going to get a verdict, a jury conviction, right after the next commercial break.
He says most African Americans don't support the marches. They realize there are still many unanswered questions around the shooting, but the loudest voices are getting the most attention.
You have a handful of individuals who are going out as representative of the African American community in this city. They couldn't lead anybody out of a wet paper bag, and I wouldn't follow any of them to a dog show.
Mike McClure, the 35-year-old pastor of the Rock Church in Birmingham, views the protest differently. Emantic Bradford Jr. and his mother often attended his church, and he officiated Saturday's funeral at the Boutwell Auditorium. The protesters, he says, have a definite impact. Last week, he got a call to meet with city and religious leaders in Hoover to talk about the protest.
I don't get that phone call if the protesters don't shut down the highway.
He's referring to the demonstrations last week when protesters blocked all four lanes of U.S. 31 in Hoover near City Hall. McClure's family tree is planted in civil rights advocacy. His grandfather is Bishop Calvin Woods, leader of Birmingham's Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He says the protests are helpful, but the Birmingham-Hoover metro area needs to go beyond that to move forward.
We want to be able to say, okay, the Hoover police, let's put a program together where you're with some of us, people of diversity, and we show you how to talk to us, how to work with us. Let us help train you on what you see when you see our young men.
Mike McClure says those changes can't happen until Hoover reveals what happened the night Bradford was shot. The Alabama Law Enforcement Agency is handling the investigation. Hoover officials say if Aaliyah doesn't release more details by today, the city could release them. Cheryl Wheeler-Stewart, WBHM.
This the city of Chicago.
New Census Bureau data shows many people who live on Chicago's west and south sides don't have internet at home. WBEZ's Maria Ines Samudio reports.
Inglewood was at the top of the list with 56% of the homes without internet. Quabini Daniels
with the civic engagement nonprofit Mikva Challenge, says access to the internet is a crucial resource.
If my community so happens to, you know, house resources that's only available online, I can check my alderman's website and see what garbage pickup services are offered to me.
Internet subscription rates are highest downtown and on the north side. Marina Zamudio, WBEZ News.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
So far this year in the United States, there have been 36 school shooting incidents. 17 people were killed in the deadliest of them in Parkland, Florida, and another 10 in a shooting in Santa Fe in Texas. Those attacks appear to have encouraged more states to try to pass legislation that will allow teachers and school staff to be armed. Many states already allow it, including Ohio, where this year an estimated 400 more teachers have gone through the training they need to be able to carry a gun in their classrooms. Our North America correspondent, Aline McBall, joined the latest group of teachers trying to qualify.
Something terrible is happening down there. You've got to do something.
Got a gun. Got a gun. Got a gun. Got a gun.
And stop.
It's a mock-up of a deadly school shooting, and teachers who've been training for 3 days in the Ohio countryside are putting their new firearm skills into practice to prepare if they qualify today for being armed when they get back to their schools.
They first volunteered, they were vetted by their schools to make sure that they are competent, trustworthy and willing.
Joe Eaton runs this course and, of course, has no doubts about the merits of arming teachers.
Every one of these people here, if violence comes to their school tomorrow, they're all going to the sound of that violence. They're going to stand between a murderer with a rifle and these innocent kids.
Take your masks off and gather around.
A lot of the teachers being trained, though, were clearly conflicted about the whole idea. Ohio is one of 14 states where teachers are already armed at some schools. We can't name these teachers, both school principals, for security reasons.
What compelled you to come here?
We're a very isolated school building. It takes a tremendous amount of time to get any law enforcement to our building. And we just felt like that, you know, we needed to be prepared.
What was your experience with firearms in the past?
Very, very limited. I'd say less than five times, you know, ever firing a firearm.
You're in your profession because you care about young people. There are people who react in horror at the thought of teachers being armed.
Well, it's just a situation we want to make sure that if we're going to pull the trigger that it's worth absolutely everything. It's pretty tough to think that if this is something inside your own building, it might be a kid that you know or might be a kid that you see every day. You know, to make that call is pretty tough feeling.
Back together, reset, reset, reset.
As well as his fears of having to shoot dead one of his own students if he or she was the attacker, after one exercise, that same head teacher raised another concern to an instructor.
Like if you would be at a cafeteria and a student would raise a gun, point some at people, and you would take him down and it ends up being a toy gun.
No. You're defending everybody else, but in that case, you've identified what would appear to be a clear threat. There's already case law established like that for police officers.
His worry about shooting dead a student with a toy gun was shut down by a trainer.
Come on down the hallway, folks. Come on down the hallway.
And some might find the next scenario the teachers were being put through alarming.
I need two volunteers.
As some of the teachers waited outside to take turns at the exercise, we heard the trainer preparing the others to act out the situation.
I want you in the center, pretend slap fighting.
The incident involved two students having a fight, and one would suddenly pull out a knife.
And then start slashing out at the people around you. Scenario, start!
We went in as the armed teacher approached the school fight.
Oh, man, there's some kind of fight in the hallway. Two kids are going at it. All right, stop.
The student who pulled out the knife is shot dead.
Clean shots, clean hits. Nicely done.
The teacher who pulled the trigger voices his unease.
I mean, just because I see a knife, is that the reason to pull the trigger?
What was the situation going on?
Well, she wasn't coming at me. I mean, I did hesitate just a little bit till I seen...
That's why you're learning.
Okay. But what should I have done? Not hesitated?
If you know that that knife's being used as a weapon against somebody, yeah, okay. You're protecting a third party is what that's called.
All right.
But the trainers reinforce why the student with a knife should have been shot dead.
How much distance can the average person cover in 2 seconds with that bladed implement in their hand? Especially if we're thinking about high school age kids, for example. Easily 20 feet plus. So yes, that is a lethal force implement.
Course qualification is focused solely on target practice.
Shooters, listen for the beep!
26 hits of 28 shots at a human-shaped target, and the teacher qualified, taking the next step to joining the ranks of those already armed in America's schools.
That report by Alim Makbul.
I'm going to talk about that report first, and then we'll do the normal protocol. So, Gus T, I was at yoga training today for 8 hours, have an additional 8 hours tomorrow, and I had 2 hours yesterday. So while Gus T was at 8 hours of yoga training, you have race soldiers who are signing up. Yeah, let the Negro do the yoga training. Yes, we're signing up. Where's the training where you can tote a firearm in the elementary school? Where's that training? That's the one that I want to sign up for. You can let the Negro, let him take all the yoga classes. I want the training where you can learn how to shoot to kill in the elementary school. Where is that training at? Yes, sign me up. In that their report, and remembering the words of the grandsester, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, when we play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. In that segment, from the BBC, no less, they said, that's why we train. That was the response given from the instructor who sounded like a white person. There was no video to this. Sounded like a white person, the instructor. He said, that's why we train. That was his response when they were in this training simulation. And different white man who was training, he fired. The simulation was if there was a student with a knife. And he said he hesitated, like, wow, we supposed to shoot to kill if he's got a knife? He said, I hesitated. I don't know. We supposed to kill? And again, it sounded like he even said with a smile, that's why we train, so you won't hesitate. Bam, put him down. They said in the same segment, they said, hey, explaining why you put him down. He said, hey, how much distance can a human cover with a knife in, you know, a short period of time? And a student, we're talking about young people here. Them Negroes are fast, especially the young ones. He said, about 20 feet. That's lethal. Put him down. Got to put him down. That's what he said in the report. And they said they were just doing the target practice. That was what he saw. Doing target practice and target practice to put him down. Not even, I didn't hear anything about, you know, potentially injure or we're trying to just get, you know, get them subdued. We're not looking for a lethal fire here. I didn't hear anything of that. It was take them down. Again, what I've said consistently, there should be a lot of conversation about your child's academic plan before conception. Before you get to the bedroom, that when they talk about Mr. Fuller, those 200 questions, that should be in the 200. Like, do you have an idea for, you know, what you would like, what a black child's academic plan should look like for the first 10 years? You know, is that something that you've thought about? You know, the schools around here, whatever it is, natural childbirth, you know, breastfeeding, all of that. Very important conversations to have because that is a lot of the damage right there. Racism, white supremacy, that's who's waiting on your child. Armed resource officer waiting to put them down. Now, normal protocol, context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. I do not have children. That is a reason why right there. Awesome responsibility to be a attempted parent in the system of white supremacy. That's your job right there. Part of your job, put it that way. Today's date, Saturday, December 8, 2018. So I have been told. I think this week was Fred Hampton Jr. Day. I might be misinformed. If I had remembered that earlier, I would have included a sound clip of Fred Hampton. But I think it was Fred Hampton Jr. Day this week. He was assassinated, making me do math, 49 years ago this week, December 4, unless my memory is bad, December 4, 1969, 49 years ago, Fred Hampton. But I think it is they celebrate Fred Hampton Jr. Day. If folks recognize any holidays, it is the season. So I have been told this is the compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, suggestions. The number is 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Few things before we dial in. First, lots of interference. There have been a number of listeners. We've had continued interference with the iTunes feed, interference with the phone line, where people were having difficulties dialing in, with the VOPE line. All of this is standard operating procedure to be expected within the system of white supremacy. If you have obstacles accessing the broadcast, you can drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. And or let me know. I've messaged out and tweeted about the archives as well as the phone information. That seems to be a more recent issue with people reporting that there have been issues with them trying to dial in for the phone. But that is the system of white supremacy. And I can only stress loudly again, that has been the case for the duration of the 10 years that we have been on the air. And I strongly suspect, or I have concluded, if we were on this broadcast and we were, it's about the end of the year. So if we were getting ready for, you know, the coon of 2018, you know, and speculating for who's going to be coon of 2019, I don't think we would be having all these problems. I think we would have crystal reception every time, and our archives would be uploading to iTunes without issue. I could be in error, but that is a conclusion I have come to. Before we get to the folks who dialed in, invest if you think the broadcast is constructive. We are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. Much obliged to all the investors who have supported for 10 years and kept the cows on the air. Listeners have kept us broadcasting. I hope we have been worthy of your time and energy for the past decade. If you are not into PayPal, you can hit the Amazon wish list. It is under Gus T. Renegade. It is linked at my blog directly under my PayPal button. You can do the search at Amazon, Gus T. Renegade. Again, tremendous gratitude to all of the listeners who have nabbed items from my wish list. I hope the program has shared constructive, accurate information about what white supremacy racism is, what it means to be classified as white, what non-white people, victims of racism, can do to get this problem solved immediately. Few things to share before we get to the callers. Wow. I felt super satisfied with the very first clip, or one of the first segments that we played from this week. when they talked about in Sacramento, now the system of racism, white supremacy, the primary weapon is deception. So it could have been that that was a false report. I'm going to see if we can get the folks in Sacramento on the program to get more details. But to hear their efforts to reducing infant mortality and that yoga seemed to factor into that equation somehow, and to hear what sounded like black females saying specifically, we would have never done this. We would have never had access even to this and the health benefits of yoga. Wow. What have I been talking about all year long? Why did I even do prenatal teacher training? Why was I even at the training today? Only non-white person present. They had gals, they had guys, they were all classified as white. Only non-white person present at the training, just about refining how you teach and really use words in the practice of teaching yoga. But wow, I felt so super satisfied in what I have said and how I've even investing some of my time and energy with that today, because I, you know, do kind of feel like, wow, I could be doing other things as opposed to being here with these race soldiers and doing down dog or what have you. But absolutely, I felt much better. And particularly, I think I'll be really satisfied if we can do the cows yoga retreat and not have any conflict or super, super difficult problems. If we can do that and without injury, I would be really satisfied because I think I have learned enough that I could do some competent teaching that would hopefully folks would feel a little better and might even take an interest in doing some yoga. But whew, that was spectacular to hear. Cal's Yoga Retreat, 10 years, February 2010 or 2019. More details to come. Let's see. The segment where they talked about the hog tying in North Carolina, and I played Burt Reynolds died this year. Every time I think of Burt Reynolds, I think of Deliverance and white culture, where you have a white man anally sodomizing another white man and making him squeal like a pig, the bestiality of it all, the homoeroticism, all of that, all in one. Burt Reynolds. Anyway, but I played that deliberately with the North Carolina segment because there have been so many incidents. The segment when we talked to Dr. Curry about the man knot, where he addresses this and the homoeroticism of the prison, that was why I played it. I wanted that thought to be in people's mind. The homoeroticism of all this, the binding, that is a part of the sex, right? The S&M, they call it, binding, bondage, another individual. Anyway, that was a part of it. But they also, in North Carolina, that was where they were putting hot sauce on the genitals of the inmates. We talked about that with Dr. Curry last year. In that segment, it sounded like a white journalist. I didn't have video for that one. The white journalist, he giggled and he said, or he said first, he said it was strange. And then he giggled that the officers were cleared of hog tying this Negro before they had finished the investigation. The FBI hadn't even, you know, released their report about this incident, and they were already cleared and, you know, put back, no wrongdoing, nothing wrong here. You can hog tie a Negro in North Carolina. No issue here. And he giggled with that. And I thought that right there, if this is someone classified as white, which I suspect it is, that right there could be a conscious act of racism, because that's not the correct term. And I feel like in my view, that's why he laughed. It's not strange. That's predictable in the system of racism, white supremacy. You can put hot sauce on their genitals. This is North Carolina. Of course you can hog tie a Negro. And if he dies, well, you know, hey, got more hogs, got more Negroes in North Carolina. Moving forward, I mean, come on. Not ignorant. That laughter, we've talked about that before. The black community, speaking of police terrorism, now in Alabama, and I don't even follow the police shootings. I've said that for a long time. I don't pay attention to these. I don't watch all the video and keep track. These incidents are going to happen as long as the system of white supremacy exists. All of that said, that segment I thought was significant because I did see this week that they released the autopsy report that E.J. Bradford Jr. was shot in the back three times. Not that, you know, I was surprised, stunned with that information, but that's important. Okay, shot him in the back, to be expected. They don't, they're for their focus, the good folks at WBHM, that's Birmingham's public radio station in Alabama, they don't focus on that. They focus on, well, the Negros are, you know, in dispute with how they are responding to this shooting. Let's go and interview. What do you think of, what do you think about the Negros leading the protest and do that all the time? That's why Mr. Fuller said VGQ, victims guarantee qualified. That is exactly why he came up with that concept. So when they come and they put the microphone in your face, what do you think about the Negros protest down the street? Even if you think it's the worst thing ever. Well, I think they're doing what they're doing and they're qualified to do so. That's all you got to say? You don't coon of the year? Nothing? I think they're doing what they're doing, and they're qualified to do so. You could even make it shorter than that. And then get back to, I do want to say that I think the system of white supremacy and the white and boop, 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 whatever else you want to say, but they are so skilled at doing that, and a lot of that could be eliminated with, what do you mean, black community? We are in a system of white supremacy. There is no black. That would diffuse a whole lot of that to begin with. Correct use of, that's why Mr. Fuller has been saying that for years. Very important, paying, that's all I've talked about all day long, paying attention to words, being refined, precise with what you say. Words are so critically important. We do not have a black community. The whites can talk about having a yoga community. They have that. Gus T is not a part of. We black people do not have a community, not in the system of white supremacy. The use of terms. When they were talking about Wisconsin, man, I thought of Rob in Wisconsin. So glad. So, I think so many people were so happy that he got to California. If you are listening and want to give a thought about that segment, feel free. But I thought of Rob in Wisconsin quite a bit. But when they were talking about that segment and the trauma, and I've been to Wisconsin, they were talking about the terrorism of being a black person living in progressive Wisconsin, and have the black community is not being cared for or supported when you're around all of these progressive liberal whites. Again, in, I don't even know what they mean when they say progressive. I think we've talked about liberal. Even Malcolm X talked about the term liberal. A lot of this just comes, what does it mean to be classified as white? I've said consistently, microaggression. That's a term that I've said should not be used. Marginalized, they use that as well, should not be used. If we're talking about terrorism, that's what we're talking about. E.J. Bradford, that is not a microaggression. The armed enforcement officials in the schools where they're ready to shoot to kill, I do not think of that as a microaggression. We're talking about terrorism, violence on all levels, whether it's direct violence, indirect violence, violence in all form, fashion. Use terms that describe it as such, and the perpetrators of that violence are classified as white. That's what that designation means. Being very direct about that with the terms that we use. And in my view, being confused when we're not being accurate, even when we're not being honest with ourselves about that and not being able to be honest in articulating that, I think that contributes to a lot of the stress and mental health. Just having to lie, to lie and being confused. Confusion is not healthy. That is, I will stop there. That's just one to think on. Confusion is not healthy. Last two, I can give two yoga incidents for the week. Could probably give many more, but I'll give two for this week. Incident number one, I'll give them in chronological order. There was an instructor leaving, going to South America. These whites travel constantly. They talk all the time about how yoga teachers are so poor and you don't make a lot of money being a yoga teacher. They travel everywhere short of Mars doing yoga retreats and training and 3 months sabbatical to go study in India. It is system of racism, white supremacy. Yoga teacher is leaving. She's going to South America. This is a white woman. She's going to South America to study for an indefinite period of time. This is something that she's done repeatedly. So she's this is her last class. I've been going to this class for months now during the flood. So we get to the end of the class, and I'm like, you know, thanks for the class. Been great. Enjoyed it. She did have, you know, a really pleasant class. And she says, right on, Gus. And she says, because there's a different instructor who's also leaving. And she said, I just have to tell you, we sat and we had a whole little session where we were talking about you. And as further confirmation of what I've said before, you are under surveillance, victim of white supremacy. And she said, we were talking about you, and we were talking about your practice. And she used what has been my word of the year, inspired. She said, your practice and just being so inspired and kind of checking to see what you're doing, because you don't always follow, you know, exactly what cues are being given. And she said, I'm trying to think of the exact wording. It was, it was either self-centered. I think it might have been self-centered. It was one of those words that people that does not necessarily have always have a positive connotation. One of those words that sometimes can have what they might call an adverse connotation, where someone is not necessarily trying to be complimentary. And that has been a pattern. I've talked about that before, not just with me and yoga, but beyond, where it'll be situations where whites are trying to be complimentary, and it seems like it's difficult, or they will end up saying something that's not quite a compliment, because I just, the training in the system of racism, white supremacy, and how you think of the Negro, the man not, the woman not, how they think of, how are you going to give a sincere compliment? I've had it happen so many times, even with the yoga classes. Remember I said that one about October, where I took a lot of classes, and the one white woman, suspected racist, she said it was intimidating. The other incident that happened, and she even self-corrected when she said self-centered. She said, oh, not in a bad way. I'm not trying to say you're selfish or anything. And then she, you know, went about second incident. So I go to class. This is a what added content. This is a morning class. That's really where I get down, going early morning to do my yoga. I go for the morning class. I walk in, non-white female. I've seen her before. Hey, greetings. What's up? She speaks. We talk for a second. She's a yoga instructor as well. I try to always be cordial, especially cordial to non-white people that I see. So I go put my mat down first. I go put my mat down first. I'll say that one more time. I go put my mat down first. There were very few people in the class. This was not a full class, so there was a lot of space. So I put my mat down. The non-white female, she's non-white, non-black. She says, I forgot my attire. You know, whatever she was going to normally wear for class. She says she kind of overslept and was in a hurry, so she didn't get all of her yoga gear. Happens to the best of us. And she says, I only have my sports bra on. She's talking to the instructor, not me, but I'm standing like 2 feet from her, so I cannot help but hear. So she's explaining all of this. Whatever. I'm going to put my mat down. I normally pick my spot, as I've said before, I deliberately pick spots that are, you know, in the corner. I normally get the same spot in the upper front corner, so I'm kind of away from everybody. I'm not that close to anybody, and I'm on the front row, so there's no one in front of me, so I'm not really looking directly at any other students. So I don't really care. I'm going to get my spot. Actually, there is another irregularity. The instructor was kind of in my spot, even though she was going to move. But since it was so few people, I didn't care. I was just going to take the opposite spot. So instead of being in the front upper corner, front right corner, I'll be in the front left corner. Same thing. No big deal. So I go get my corner spot. The non-white female who says she forgot her attire, she comes and has her mat next to mine. Now, at the time, she still has her sweatshirt on. No big deal, whatever. In fact, I'm doing headstand at the beginning of class. That's kind of my thing to get warmed up. So we get rolling. We're about 10 minutes into class, 75-minute class. She takes off her sweatshirt. Immediately, Bill Cosby, I have moved. In fact, I am notorious for moving. When people come into class and they get like close to where I am, I have picked up and moved immediately. Like as soon as they came and put their mat down, like even if it was a non-white person, like I want my space. I've been kicked. I've talked about that before. Not interested in having folks next to me. We just read The Man Knot, right? And they talked about they used eyeball rape. That was the term that was in the book, right? And I said, I'd never heard that. I'm familiar with reckless eyeballing. I said, there is no way reckless eyeballing. If this had been a white woman, I think I would have moved. Even if this had been like in the flow of class, which I hate doing, having to move once class has started, I think I would have still moved if it had been a white woman. Because I just like, whoa. We are not going to have a Bill Cosby moment where, you know, whoa, he was looking at me and I felt uncomfortable. And come on. And even I would have taken that some kind of way if that had been a white woman who had done that, who had, you know, already made it clear that they didn't have whatever. Like, why are you going to? There's lots of space. There's no need for you to be right here at all. Like, and even if it had been a non-white female, if I didn't know her, I think I would have. Bill Cosby on my mind on a regular basis. And I said, I'll have to adjust my counter-racist code for that sort of thing to make sure that I'm safe in the yoga environment. But generally, I'm off to the corner. I'll have to be mindful of that in the future. Might need to move if something like that happens, especially if I do not know who the person is. We will end there. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your commentary, that way everyone has an opportunity to speak. If you have additional questions, suggestions, you can share once everyone has had at least one chance to share. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just helps to minimize distortion so we don't have to talk over a lot of unnecessary racket. Much obliged. And no metaphors. We had... What, did you hear some of the metaphors in the segment where they had the black community reflecting? they said you got people down there leading those protests who couldn't lead their way out of a wet paper bag. Now, that might be true. It is a metaphor, but still, VGQ. They had plentiful metaphors in that segment. If we could be direct about what it is that we want to say. Explicit racists frequently, they will use metaphors to enforce ideas of racism, white supremacy, and they will use metaphors to practice deception. Frequently, they will insist that two concepts are identical. They'll use analogies or comparisons to reinforce this false notion. Many victims, we've been exposed to this nonsense for years, myself included, and many of us, we are still learning. As such, sometimes we'll use metaphors, analogies in place of logic. If we could make an effort, sometimes we just need to think a little bit more to collect information or to process how we want to articulate our thoughts correctly, accurately. That is always welcome, but if we could not use metaphors, that would be grand. I will prompt about that. With that, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed. number of folks who have hands up.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I really wanted to speak on those, the metaphors, too. I think another one was he said something about I wouldn't let them lead me to, I think he said a doghouse or something. Did you hear that one, too?
I believe so. It was a number of them. He had a number of colorful metaphors included. I think I remember that one as well.
Yeah, that was wow, and especially with the animal comparison there. I have been. It was a trailer. I know this is about the entertainment thing, but I think it's. I just don't even see it the same way. I hear people on the job, they was talking about the Lion King trailer. So that really just made me, I don't know, the animal comparison. I just wanted to just speak on that really quick. And as far as the segment on the school shooting, I think they was doing the training. I did catch that too, where the person was like, hey, you want me to just shoot the person and he just has a knife and you don't even want me to hesitate? He's like, no, just go ahead and just shoot him. That'll be the end of it. And I thought about when you said how white people don't value children. I think that's what, I don't know if it was a direct quote, they don't care about children. There was another thing that I heard this week about the guy who was the football player who was a victim of racism from the white woman was supposedly playing, quote unquote, playing the victim, or she was thinking that something was happening to her. More so, they showed that he also got in other fights at other venues or clubs or whatever. And I'm thinking that for some reason, racism was essential in that as well. And it's interesting how they definitely have a way of being deceitful and how they acknowledge you in what we would think would be a correct way. And you have a lot of success going on for you and you accumulate a lot of money and attention. And then all of a sudden, problems are presented to you, and we, being in the confused state that we're in, we don't necessarily know where it's coming from, and they know that we're confused. And I do agree that they are not ignorant, but when you're talking to them, they make it seem like, oh, was that really racist? I mean, come on, like I just made a joke about you wearing sneakers or something. They can come up with anything and apply it to you as a black person. And they try to make it seem like, oh, I just said something about shoes and a gold chain. So, how could that be racist? I have my white buddy, he lives down the street. He owns those same things. And I say it to him. And they try to explain it in a way to make it seem like they say that to a white person too, to get you to not further suspect them or to just accurately understand that they are practicing racism. And that's all I have right now. And thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. I would not be totally surprised if the segment in Alabama where they had the black male talking about the quote unquote black community, I would not be totally stunned if that was written by whites, scripted, as they say. Stranger things have happened. So that would be one. He still has VGQ, even if it all is authentically that that's what he said. And those are his thoughts. VGQ, victims guaranteed qualified, but metaphors definitely important, especially as you said, the one, I wouldn't let them lead me to the doghouse, comparing black people to man not, woman not, as I said. Other folks dialed in, if you have commentary to share, lines should be open. Proceed. While folks are spectating, I see other hands. Don't know if folks are in, folks are in locations where they are not able to speak yet. As I said, I do think that shooting segment, super important for anyone. I don't even have children, and I thought that was super important. If you are an attempted parent, really think seriously about that, especially if you have children that are in the so-called public schools, to even investigate. Do they have a resource officer at your child's school? Is the resource officer armed at your child's school? Like, what do they have the same philosophy that if, you know, something breaks out, they see a child with a toy gun? And even from that segment, the way that they discussed it, it was, well, if it's a child and they have a toy gun and it looks realistic and you shoot them, hey, it's legal. We already got precedent on that. You're covered. It's legal. It wasn't a, oh, wait a minute, you know, maybe there should be some caution, you know, just in case these are children that has been known to happen for someone to bring in a toy gun, trying to be cool or whatever. Maybe, you know, hesitate. You don't need to rush to pull out that gun to fire it. That wasn't it at all. It was, oh, we already got the law on your side. Go ahead and shoot to kill. And that is exactly what I said about whites. They do not care about children. I've said that way back, I think, with Sandy Hook 2012, when there was a lot of pretending that they were upset or disgruntled about that. Anywho, I will take a moment to give folks, if they are in need of a second, to get themselves situated. As I said, there should be more details about the supposed Cal's Yoga Retreat for the 10-year anniversary. Looking like Tennessee, would think it wouldn't be anything more than 3 to 4 days. I would think I've seen yoga retreats that are a week and something longer. I wouldn't want to do anything that long. Just as I said, maybe a weekend or 3 or 4 day max for length. There'll be more details to come, but just kind of giving people, because there were folks who were already emailing and asking for information. So I can at least take a few moments to give some of the thoughts about what that might include. I'm pretty sure that each of the days, if it's a 3 day thing, 2 day thing, I'm thinking minimum 3 days. If it would include doing some yoga each of the days that we're there, and then also doing an exchange of views, presentation on racism, white supremacy while we're there as well, so we can do the counter-racism, do the yoga, even combining the two. Certainly, if folks have ideas about what to be presented, topics to be covered during that time, that would be grand. Some people already wrote in with information to address that, so that would be great. Folks have thoughts. We certainly have enough time to kind of develop I would hope we could perhaps do something in the similar to Satya X, if people got to hear when she was on the program in the spring of this year, where they have a yoga retreat that's for black females exclusively, and they do yoga. I think they talk about racism. They talk about health. They talk about diet. That's where I was going. They have, I think all of the meals are, if not vegan, definitely vegetarian. I think no alcohol. She talked about all that when she was on the program. So it'd be great if we could do something that's similar to that. I know some of the folks who spoke with me about the or emailed expressed interest in the yoga retreat. They were talking about health or different aspects or ways that yoga can be used for health and diet is very closely associated with the practice of yoga. So that would be grand, but you can certainly email if you have ideas for things to be covered, talked about during that time period. As I said, we'd be looking at February 2019, just trying to get details, and all of that should be coming within the next few weeks. But yeah, I'd be super excited about the prospect and doing some yoga, sharing some yoga and counter-racist ideas together. That would be awesome, but should be more details to come. Folks did email with interest. Much obliged. The survey is there. Thanks to all the folks who filled that out already, and we will have more details to come. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have comments, questions, thoughts you would like to share. 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have questions, comments, thoughts. Other folks who dialed in, other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have thoughts, proceed. Folks are doing their spectating, and I see hands too. That's always confuses me when I see hands and then people are still being quiet. So I'll give them a moment. I'll remember Pamela Evans Harris, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. That is something that she would, I won't say scold, but she would definitely remind sternly, which I always thought was appropriate and appreciated when she would remind us about the importance of not being spectators, and this isn't even a broadcast that is designed for spectators at all. This one is specifically designed for victims of racism to exchange views, not to just listen to, you know, whomever is supposed to be chatting it up. We do not get counter-racism just to sit around and listen. It's supposed to be actively employed in terms of exchanging views. And I am sure there are some interesting things that had to happen over this week, even the postage being stopped on Wednesday. I don't know if I'm poorly informed or if I just missed the information that they were suspending postage service this past week for the funeral services of GHW, former president. Like, I had no idea this was like a national thing. System of racism, white supremacy, that they can that quickly get something nationally stopped to recognize suspected race soldier and his life and legacy. It just goes back. I'm daily reminded when Mr. Fuller talks about whites being able to get things done, when they talk about it being difficult to do this, it being difficult to do that. If it's something that they want to do, they can get it done. I'm sure there were a lot of whites who said that they had packages and this, that, and the other that needed to be delivered on time, this date, all of that going to the side. We have to pause to recognize the great George H.W. and his contributions to the system of white supremacy. And I mean, really, unless I'm in error, if it is someone classified as white, and they're being recognized, and I mean, if they're really, if it's going to be, you know, a major celebratory occasion, it has got to be in recognition for what they did to support the system of white supremacy racism. I cannot imagine it being, yes, we're going to stop and have a parade and a celebration, and we're going to stop the United States Postal Service for someone classified as white who was not in agreement with the system of racism. That's not logical, feasible at all in a system of racism. Other folks dialed in. We'll see if folks have a thought to share.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for taking my call. I hope everyone's having the best evening possible. Great clips. I guess about the Heather Heyer, I'm not surprised that the man was convicted. It was a white person. So that's like no surprise. And also, I guess on a personal note, what I'm starting to do now is when people talk to me about things that I won't say aren't important, but, you know, like, let's say the Golden Globes. Oh, so-and-so was nominated for Golden Globes, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's great, great for them, whatever. What does that have to do with the war in Flint? And I just say that, well, first, I still kind of want to know. I feel bad for those people. I still want to know what's going on with that. But also to bring attention to there are important and constructive things that we can be working on. So you may not say that, but something in your community, you know, you might say, oh, well, are you taking any yoga classes? Whatever it is, to kind of get off something that you know is not constructive, that is not going to help anybody do anything. And I've done it, like, mainly just to my mother. But it started to work because I was saying, we were talking, and she was saying something. She was like, yeah, what does this have to do with the water in Flint? Like, you know, like, what we're talking about is not really important. We should kind of move on to more important things. So that's just a little practice I've been starting. Thank you.
Much obliged. And that black self-respect, I think. Black self-respect, and I think that would also qualify as Mr. Fuller has a concept, compensatory conversation control, I think it is. I could be in error, but I think that's what it is. But when you see the conversation is going towards something that's not, you know, constructive, talking about TV or gossiping and, you know, all of that, you can just move. And it doesn't even have to be that, as you said, you got options. It doesn't have to be as what's going on with the situation in Flint or what happened with EJ Bradford. Oh man, have you been able to do some healthy eating? I heard this segment, they were talking about trying to eat more vegetables and being vegan, doing some plant-based. Have you heard anything about that? What are you doing with your diet? Anything, you know, of constructive value, always excellent. And that's why Mr. Fuller, I think, has said for a long time, minimizing contact, because the tendency is for it to go non-constructive. So if you keep trying, get it back somewhere constructive, and it keeps going, then might be time to find the exit. Others dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm a very, very long-time listener and first-time caller. And I'm a fellow Seattleite, and a yoga teacher, and I've been very much interested in what your experiences have been as a yoga teacher, especially as a non-white experiencer of yoga, and so on and so forth. And it's been really interesting what your experiences have been up to now, just listening to what you've had to undergo as far as being a male in a very white setting as a non-white individual.
Much obliged, first-time caller dialing in here in Seattle, no less. That's stunning. Do you practice, or do you? It's just been interesting to hear.
I do practice here and there, not as regularly, because when I started my yoga teacher training a long time ago, that was back in 2000. I did 2 teacher training intensive back then, and did it for a while. I was teaching, and then I went through a very nasty divorce and just some emotional things that I couldn't get over and stopped practicing yoga. I think the emotional part of when I stopped practicing yoga on a regular basis, I just got too caught up in my emotions that I just could not do it. I just didn't have the discipline to continue doing the practice. So, and I stopped teaching yoga as well, but I've been thinking about taking it back up again. I did it right here in Issaquah, my yoga teacher training in Issaquah, as well as in Redmond.
How about that? Was racism a major factor in your training or in your experience as a teacher?
It was interesting because I was the only non-white teacher in the yoga training intensive, and both times I was going through the teacher training, I was the only non-white person. And on top of that, I don't know why every time I was chosen to become the teacher at the yoga center, it was the strangest thing. I would always get selected as the one to get on board and teach at their teacher. What is it called? So there's that one called the Yoga Barn in Issaquah, and there's the other one that's probably long gone. It was called the Yoga Center or something. I can't remember. But it was really strange that they selected me every time to become one of their teachers and lead their classes. It was interesting. And I asked why, and they said they liked my voice and that I had this type of energy that made me a good fit to be a teacher. Even though I was very young at that time, I was probably relatively young. I was in my early 30s. And I think as a yoga teacher, I didn't think that I was mature enough to take up that kind of responsibility. But I still was selected, and I did it. I was every time I was to teach a class, I was just a nervous wreck, but I just I got it done. There were some complaints from some of the class. The people who were taking classes that I would just be too quiet or my voice could not be heard, and things like that. And that was because I was very shy. And still am, but I'm starting to get over it as I mature. But I have to say that I have a very different perspective as far as I am a non-white person, woman. I grew up in Africa, and my mother married a white guy from Germany when I was very young, and then the family was moved to Germany to live there for just a little while, and so I learned German at a very young age. So I grew up as a young black girl, young African girl in Germany, and learned the language. And I just didn't get exposed to the same type of racism. I don't know if that even. It's a different type of racism in Europe. I would have to think about how to describe it and articulate it. But knowing the language gave me a different perspective of the culture there. And I grew up inside of the culture, within the German culture. And so that was an interesting part of my life, and still is.
Fascinating. I'm reminded again of the grandsister, Dr. Welsing. I'm sure she would have a lot of questions to ask someone like yourself who grew up in that environment, and particularly being able to speak the language. Certainly you get a much, how would I say, richer, more comprehensive experience, I think, the better you can understand the language and, you know, what's happening around you, what people are saying. You can, I think, get a much deeper understanding of really the white supremacy culture and symbolism that, you know, we are all immersed in. I will let you know if I'm doing any teaching so that you can come hang out if you are so interested. in the area. It's Absolutely. Wonderful to know we have Black Yogi in the area who is a listener, no less. Like, that is amazing. Let me check to see if we have any other folks and, yeah, to see if you have any other yoga stories you would like to share with us. Let's see. Other folks, if you have a hand up and we've not heard from you at all, if you have commentary, proceed. Yes, ma'am. Your line is not very clear. It's very disrupted.
Oh, it is.
You're a little better now. It's if your volume, it might just be that your volume was a little low. Maybe you could speak up or get closer to your microphone.
Okay, can you hear me better now?
A little bit.
Is that better?
Yes, a little better.
Okay. Yeah, this is Stephanie. Hi, Dustin, I guess. I just wanted to discuss really quickly about the what's with the vegan, gentleman that was just talking about how they were trying to compare somebody, I guess, was trying to compare vegans with non-white black people was being discriminated upon. And I'm also a vegan. I just found that to be very interesting how everybody wants to compare their plight with non-white black people. I just found that very interesting. And the incident in North Carolina with the gentleman in Hawkeye, I'm here in North Carolina, and I had no idea that this had happened. I am right in the area right where this happened at, and I did not know about the hot dog incident either. I hadn't heard anything about any of that. So I do thank you for sharing those clips to allow me to be more aware. They seem to not hear there's not as much brutality going on in this area. But as I just stated, made it clear by the clips that, yes, the same thing is going on here in North Carolina and right here in my area. And I have also, I think maybe about a week or two ago, I did have problems with the vote line. Also, when I tried to call in, it was not giving me the option where to say call. It was just feeling like the number was disconnected or something. There was something strange going on. So, and I just wanted to call in just to say hi and just participate a little bit. I haven't been able to participate in workplace space. What the young lady shared about the conversation, hearing the conversation to something more constructive, I have been implementing that very often, especially on my job, where I work with non-white victims, but, it's very toxic, of course. And I've just been, when the gossiping test goes on, I just tend to steer the conversation to something more constructive or respect, as I was instructed by you, that them. Don't try not to even say anything,
make
no comment at all. And that's all I have. And thanks for allowing me to share.
Spectacular with the conversation control. And you don't have to say anything, too. That can be a big part of compensatory conversation control, just being silent. Awesome plan, always. But much obliged for sharing. I had a question that I was going to ask the group, but I'll wait on the question. Just for a workplace or any other environment, compensatory conversation control is always spectacular. And again, you don't have to say anything. Sometimes being quiet is a great response. Since workplace racism was mentioned, we did have a caller who talked about yesterday doing Lyft, some of the rideshare options that they have. Just for any victims of racism, if you're doing that, safety. I talked about that before, and I didn't mention it yesterday because this person was saying that they had suspected racist, or it was multiple, in the vehicle, and it seemed like they were under the influence. Just, you know, take safety serious, especially in those environments, because I think individuals classified as white, they're reckless, dangerous anyway with regards to black people. And I think especially when they're under the influence, I've said for years, one of the most dangerous, the most dangerous combination in the known universe, whites, alcohol, having those two together in that close space in your vehicle, I would take that very, very seriously because that could get dangerous immediately. Just wanted to make sure I emphasized that because I didn't say that when we were talking about workplace racism yesterday. Other folks dialed in, if we've not heard from you, if you have a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah. Caller out of Georgia. I just had a quick question with the news clips that you play every week. Where do you get all those news clips? Because sometimes it'd be hard for me to find them when I listen to it. The recording, beginning of the week?
A variety of sources. I try to listen to a lot of different outlets, NPR, BBC, PBS. Like these are like Democracy Now!, my BFF, Amy Goodman. I'm trying to think of some of the Young Turks. Obviously, I don't think I played any of their segments today. Seattle Public, they have two public radio stations here, so I listen to both of those. New York Public Radio. These are like regular outlets, and then there are a lot of other places that maybe I don't listen to them every week, but I'll check to see, you know, if they're talking about anything that's relevant, if they're talking directly about racism, white supremacy, or like the vegan, or I guess they did talk about racism directly, the vegan clip that you that I played. But just the variety of sources. They're like podcasts that I'll check. Just a wide variety of sources. Kind of Dr. Welsing, when she, you know, she said that Dick Gregory, the late Dick Gregory, inspired her to just try to get 20 newspapers. That's kind of the same approach that I have to try to check a lot of different sources to see, you know, what they're talking about. BBC News, that's I think it's called the Global podcast, a world podcast, something like that. But that's the BBC is where the segment about the armed officers in the school, that's where that came from. Was it like something specific that you were looking for, or just like a general query?
Probably just a general, because some of those, well, you know, are you subscribed to a lot of these publications, or how do you?
Well, some of them are podcasts some of them are not. Okay. So, you know, some of them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm not subscribed to because they're not podcasts, so.
Yeah, because some of the, like when I look up the newspaper clip, it's just, you know, it can get kind of expensive, all of them, because some like $10 a month, $20, you know, so I'll just
keep. Oh, yeah, I do not pay for any news. I refuse. I would not pay for a New York Times subscription or anybody. No, I do not pay for any news subscription. I thought you just meant like a subscription to a podcast or something that's free. No, I do not have any paid subscriptions for any news.
Oh, okay. So do you read the newspapers, though?
Yes, I read. I check the Times daily. I check the Seattle Times daily. I don't check the Washington Post as often, but I check it multiple times throughout the week. I try to check the LA Times at least once a week. Yeah, I mean, you know, I try to go to the BBC on a weekly basis. I try to go to a number of different sites to check for information. I do not claim to be the most informed or the best at it. Dr. Welsing, I feel like, really inspired me the same way that she talks about Dick Gregory, because I felt like she would always have like current and like really, really current information to kind of support her theory. So I try to make the same effort to have current information to support my views on white supremacy or just accurate information, period, relating to the system of white supremacy.
Yeah, I remember Dr. Fraser saying that often, because even like a lot of old Dick Gregory interviews, he still actually had those. He actually had the newspaper, like he had them cut out. Yeah, so that's what I was asking, because when I try to read some of the New York Times or Washington Post, they don't give me like sometimes the full story, and after a while it says things like, in order to get full access to this newspaper, you got to pay this monthly subscription. And that's why I was asking, is it a way to still read those stories without paying for them?
Most of them, yes. Most of them, yes. Mm-hmm. If it's that specifically, I know that they do have hacks, as they call it, where you can still access the article without having a paid subscription. I think the New York Times, one of the ways, and I'm sure, you know, whites might allow this for a while, they might not, but one of the ways they said you could just copy the article title, whatever it is, if it's at the Times, and then do a search, like if you're going to use Google, you could do a search using that title, and if you click it from the Google search, it will open the article. That's for whatever reason, that's one of the hacks that they had that works for the New York Times. But yeah, they have others. Like I've looked before. At any rate, I do not pay for any newspaper articles, and I generally do not have I cannot think of a newspaper article that was, you know, about something that I was not able to read because I didn't have a subscription.
Oh, okay. Oh, another question. As far as when you're doing your training or your yoga, are you currently vegan right now?
Yes, I have been vegan for the duration of this year, almost since January.
Oh, okay, okay, all right. Yeah, because I remember hearing one of your old, I think this is when Justice was still hosting, and you said you was vegan then. I think you said you came from Atlanta, you was vegetarian. So I didn't know that you, so it was a period of time that you actually stopped.
Correct. I was vegan before, then I stopped and restarted. So for most of the time that we've been doing the cows, I have not been vegan. But when we started, I was. Now I'm back.
And you think yoga contributed your diet change?
Oh, absolutely. I think I'd said that before, but yeah, absolutely. When I started doing yoga, I think it was a conscious and pretty efficient, pretty quick transition. I started doing yoga in December, and by January I was vegan, and it was a direct correlation. I mean, it was a direct relationship.
Okay. Do you think, I'm sorry, just had a few questions, because I was wondering, because I do yoga at my residence, and I was wondering, what's your experience, you know, for what you've been through with your housing situation or residence situation? Can you honestly say they actually help, I guess, with, can I say the stress? Do you think you actually, do you notice a difference in your mental or even when you're doing this attempt this counter racist work? A difference?
Absolutely. I think... number one, I mean, they give you specific, you know, techniques that you can do if you are stressed. So, you know, if I'm disgruntled about my housing situation or anything, racism, white supremacy in general, you know, they can give you specific techniques to help you calm yourself. If you're feeling some anxiety, if you're feeling depressed, if you're feeling angry, they can give you specific things to do, breathing exercises and other postures that will calm your heart rate and kind of get you to relax a little bit. So they can, that helps. I mean, it's not going to cure anything. You're still on the plantation, but you can function a little better so that you are not as stressed. And it's substantially better than, you know, let me go get this alcohol or let me go get this other poison to try to offset that Trump, it's a substantially better option. So, yeah, I think it has been very helpful in dealing with all of that sleep issues, because I've had a lot of sleep issues that I've talked about for years as well. And it can be very helpful with that as well. And just being lighter. I mean, it cannot be understated being 90 pounds lighter. That, you know, alone is astronomical.
90 pounds.
I think that's it. For sure. Cal's Yoga Retreat can do both. And that's, I mean, that's substantial. Racists, they invest so much in, you know, tearing down our bodies and having us feeling awful and having us eat terrible food and not being able to. I was the only black person at the training today. I'm regularly the only black person in class. That is not by accident. They want us eating McDonald's and terrible food, hot dogs, the worst impossible foods. I was going to say apologies to anybody who had a hot dog today, but I will not, because that is terrible food. I have had more than my share of wieners, as they say. That is terrible food. That's exactly why I was 90 pounds overweight. Hot dogs, nonsense, total trash. But that's what they want us to have, nonsense, and then not be able to do things to take care of our bodies so that we're in terrible, terrible shape. Medical apartheid, Harriet A. Washington. Other folks dialed in, if you have a hand up, if we have missed you completely, proceed. We nab all the folks. Anybody we missed who has a hand up? Grant, assume that we got everybody. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. As a vegan, I have never compared any aspect of animals being harmed in the food process, which whites do a lot of. I have not compared any aspect of that to racism, white supremacy, although that is a part of their destructive nature. But yeah, proud vegan, victim of white supremacy, no comparison. I was thinking, I think the caller in Florida mentioned the Lion King trailer. I haven't seen it. I'm not going to see the movie, obviously, but I was thinking, I thought I'd seen it, and then I couldn't remember what it looked like to pick out if I thought it was racist or not, to respond to what he was talking about. Has anybody seen the new Lion King trailer to pick out if they think why whites would be fascinated with that, some aspect of racism in the trailer? Has anybody else seen the new Lion King trailer? Not that you need to, you know, go check it out if you haven't. I guess you all haven't seen it. I thought I had seen it, but it's not coming to mind. I felt like I had seen it at some point, or at least heard of it. I know I definitely heard that it was coming. No one's seen it? No one's seen it? Yeah. I have to check it out or see if it comes across my retina at some point. I will make a note about the characters. Caller in Florida, did you see the trailer? I guess what aspect of it called to mind racism, white supremacy? Or maybe he's not with us. Are you still with us, sir? Or he might not be with us. I will check in, and I'm surprised nobody else has seen the trailer. You all are generally much better up on the entertainment than I, but I'm sure The Lion King, that's such a big Disney production that folks will be forced on us down the road at some point. Other folks, any other comments, observations folks have from the past week with the funeral, all of that, nothing stood out?
I heard that it cost about $250 million for the whole funeral service.
Wow. Wow. No concerns about the national deficit on that day. It's GHW. Wow. I hope that this is a date way down the road. Apologies for the metaphor. I hope a long period of time passes. But if, you know, let's say 100 years from now, or a long time from now, when President Obama passes, let's see what kind of circumstance and celebration that they have for the quote unquote first black president. That'll be a great comparison because we'll have this one, lots of, you know, recollections and what have you, how much they spent on it, shutting down the post service. Let's see what they do for President Obama. Again, hoping this is way down, long time away, no time soon, not wishing anything bad on him at all, just for comparison's sake. But repeat what I said before. I cannot imagine in a system of white supremacy that expenditure on someone classified as white who did not do a lot, and I mean a substantial amount, to support the system of white supremacy, domination of black people in particular. I cannot imagine. Good old GHW. Other folks have thoughts, folks that we missed completely?
Can I be heard?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Hey, how's it going, everyone? I'm calling because, about the Lion King trailer. I did see that trailer for the movie, and it just looked weird, like another cash grab from Disney. A lot of CGI effects. But my problem with Lion King is that it's actually a ripoff of the story of Sanjata Keita from Mali. So Disney is just copying, like, one of the founding stories of, you know, this black emperor, but they just put lions as the face of the characters, pretty much, for Simba, Mufasa. You know, it's supposed to be about Sanjata Keita, but they use these lions in the African savannah to prove, you know, to show the story. So that's just highly problematic. Today, I went to go speak to this lady about homes and credit and stuff. And while she was doing my application, this white lady, she found out I didn't have any children. And she found out my profession. And she said to me that, wow, you seem to have done it the right way. And, you know, I'm surprised when I meet people like you. And I was trying to understand what she meant by that. She means black people, quote unquote. She said that. That's what I think she meant, just because of the way it came off. But I found out with the home loan software that she asked me what was my ethnicity, because she looked at my name and, you know, it's not quote unquote American. So she asked my ethnicity. I told her what it was. And the software asked questions like, did you find out the applicant's race before they got the loan? And I was trying to figure out, like, why would they want to know my race for a home loan application? And based on the questions, I'm tending to believe that they have different races and people identify themselves as non-white.
Your audio is going out. Your audio is going out a little bit. If you could just.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, yeah. So I was just saying that identifying yourself as black when you're trying to qualify for a home loan in the initial stages could be a bad move. I think that the software is designed to find out who's non-white and to funnel them into a completely different system as opposed to white people. And thank you. That's about it.
So would you, much obliged for sharing, sir, that's important. Would it be, if you're going to fill out the software, do you have the option of not filling out race at all, or just don't pick black, like, you know, pick white, or, you know, what would you think would be the better option?
So in the software, the lady told me that before you never had to put the person's race, but then they changed the software. So now you have to put something down. So, I would say, if you can, I would say put white, honestly. I would say put white, because I'm, from the way the questions are being asked, it's like this, it's like they're pretty much asking the person that's doing the loan, did you know this person was non-white? Because I think they've had so many issues with discrimination. They're trying to stop it. Mm. Because why would they know if you were black before you even met up? You know, like, why would the company want to know if the person that's doing your loan knew if you were black beforehand? Mm. So that leads me to, they've had a lot of issues with this in the past, and they're trying to stop it, but I don't know how effective it is. And I'm trying to learn a little more. I should have asked her straight up, why did they need to know my race in the first place? Because that was my big issue, because the way she asked it, like, she didn't know if I was black. But I don't think there was any like confusion there. So I'm curious about the system.
Wow. She asked it as if she was confused about whether or not you are black. Wow. White people are not ignorant, and they certainly are not ignorant about who the Negroes are on the plantation. I have never met a white person who failed, had difficulty identifying Negroes. I think that would be great. I think that's a great question that you said about, do you have to fill this out? Why do I have to fill this out for the loan? I think those are great questions. And the suggestion in terms of just check white, if you're doing the software. I think we played the news clip last week that was about the software programs. They were also practicing racism, white supremacy with how loans were given out to black people. And I think in the segment last week, they were saying that black people didn't shop around as much, or just some other ways of explaining why these same results were still happening with the computer. Somehow they were still being able, the computers were even figuring out, oh, this seems like it might be a Negro. We're going to give them, you know, a lower rate for their loan, or they won't get as good a rate for their loan. But check white. I think I've even recommended that as well for different types of scenarios, not for loans. But if it's something where you think it might benefit you on an application to be identified as white, check white until someone demands that you check otherwise. Then you know you probably ran into a racist white supremacist. Someone saying, oh no, you are definitely not classified as white, and this here needs to be changed. Other folks that we missed totally?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard? I just want to comment what was said. Oh.
You said you just wanted to comment on what was said? I heard the other person as well. We'll get you also.
Yeah, just want to comment. What software was the gentleman using that was speaking before, just recently? What was the home software? I'm sorry?
I have it written down. I'll have to find it. I don't have it next to me right now. I need like a couple of minutes to find it, but I can find it.
All right.
Grand. Well, I guess perhaps we can get that information in a few moments. The other person who spoke up, did you have questions, comments you wanted to share?
Yes, this is Ken Steele. I'm calling from Santa Monica, California. Can I be heard?
Oh, greetings, Mr. Steele. Yes, sir.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay. So, there was a story that, caught my attention that seems to have gotten an update. And this is a story that, I first learned about, I think, last year. And it was a story of a person named Centoya Brown. This case is a, you know, it was presented to me as a case of an underage girl who was being sex trafficked, who killed her captors and made a harrowing escape. And for her efforts, she was imprisoned. She was given a life in prison sentence. And there was apparently a whole bunch of celebrities, and I, you know, I'm very leery of whenever some sort of cause du jour has you know, is linked to, you know, a bunch of celebrities want something to happen, because anytime I hear that, I just think that there are a bunch of suspected white supremacists that are behind the elevation of these particular stories. And the way that the story was framed, it made it very sympathetic to this person, victim of racism, Centoya Brown. And I looked at the details of the case, and it seems like this case is being used by the white supremacists that are behind this whole Me Too movement to justify the murder of black people, more specifically black males, for whatever reason. And because I took a look at, you know, the case, and it turned out that this Centoya Brown character, it turns out that he misrepresented herself as an of age, I guess, a prostitute. And she murdered her client in the middle of the night while he was sleeping, and then stole his car, and then proceeded to, I guess, have a joyride, what they call a joyride situation, and she was, which included, you know, speeding and smoking blunts. Now, I'm just saying that, I don't know if 50 years is necessarily appropriate, but I've heard of black males getting sentenced for getting similar sentences for, you know, stealing iPods. You know, I don't know if, and I use the word iPod to represent, you know, how far back some of the cases that I'm referencing are. So, you know, I don't know if her sentence is out of character when it comes to other victims of racism, but the way that this is being framed is that they're trying to justify what appears to be murder. And I think that this is just the end goal of the entire Me Too phenomenon, whereby they're just trying to justify women having the right to take the lives of black males behind whatever story that they can create, very similar to the social position that is enjoyed by police officers or suspected race soldiers at this time. And then also, I wanted to comment on, there was a situation where a victim of racism was recently bullied into making an apology to the LGBT community, and this is specifically to the LGBT community. And I'm just wondering, and this, I guess, victim is Kevin Hart, who has, you know, just a record of being on camera, displaying all types of anti-sexual behaviors and depictions. And none of that capitulation that he'd done previously was accounted for or taken into account when these new social charges were levied against him. He made mention of this, but he was still forced to issue an apology for comments that were made over a decade ago. So I just want to say that, you know, perhaps it's not the best strategy for victims of white supremacy to capitulate to these people, because they will harm you regardless of what you do. So it may just be a better strategy to remain steadfast in any sort of opinions that you may have that might not be deemed what they call politically correct, or what the white supremacists call politically correct. So I just want to also conclude by saying that the only political correctness that appears to be in effect here in the United States, it seems to be that you cannot upset the white supremacists. If you upset them at any turn, you will be forced to suffer social and political consequences. So, you know, just keep that in mind whenever you hear the term politically correct or political correctness. And I'll go ahead and mute my line at this time.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. I had a question. I'll check with a few other folks first, and then I had a question for Mr. Steele. I'll see if I get that in before we move along. Other folks, did we? Yes, hey. Sir. Yes, sir. I'm sorry?
Called Encompass, and the company is Credit Plus Incorporated.
Oh, Credit Plus Incorporated. Is that the name of the software? Don't know. I thought the person that was just talking.
Encompass.
Were you giving us the name of the software? That was what I thought. Did I hear that?
Encompass.
I don't know. It sounds like the audio is breaking up again. We'll try again. Person that just spoke up, what was your commentary?
Can you hear me, Gus?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I was saying that the name of the software is Encompass.
Encompass. Got it. That's the name of the software?
Yes.
Got it.
Like Encompass. Yes.
Encompass. Got it. Okay. And that's the one. Fill out white if you get that software for the loan application, and it demands that you fill out a racial classification, select white.
Yes. Definitely.
Got it. Maybe that's what we should do for all the loan applications. If it's any loan paperwork, software, what have you, and they demand that you put down racial classification, maybe put down white and see what happens. Other folks, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary, we have other folks. Other folks, anybody else? Oh, yes, ma'am.
Guys, I just wanted to say, in regards to the hot dog, I just thought about the electrical news. That's all I have.
About the witch report? You thought about, reminded you of Delectable Negro?
Just now, when I was thinking about the report regarding the hot dogs that they were using on a genital area.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just reminded me of
Yep, absolutely. That's why it's in my top 10, Vincent Woodard. I think when Dr. Curry was on the broadcast last June, 2017, last June, we talked about it in that context, that very incident. And that, and the, I think it was the Greensboro paper. You said you're in North Carolina. I think it was, I have to go back and look. It might have been the Charlotte Observer. Could be incorrect, but it was one of the major North Carolina publications. They did like a 5-part series on all of this abuse, and the hot sauce on the genitals was a part of all of this abuse in the North Carolina prison system. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, questions. Well, Grant, while folks are lollygagging, the question that I was going to ask, now this came up during, speaking of Dr. Curry, this came up during the book club yesterday. He has a paragraph where he says, black boys are at risk with both male and female perpetrators. The trepidation toward associating sexual abuse and rape with homosexuality in the black community must be engaged. And I said, whoa, Do you all think there's trepidation, meaning hesitancy, resistance toward associating sexual abuse and rape with homosexuality in the quote unquote black community? There's that word again. Do you all, is that your sense, folks here, have a thought on that? Is there a hesitancy towards associating sexual abuse with homosexuality?
Can I be heard?
Mr. Steele?
Yeah. From my experience, it seems that homosexuality enjoys a social position whereby you can't say anything that would disparage the practice of homosexuality. In fact, I think that by calling homosexuals gay, I think that that's some sort of rhetorical trick that was played by the, what they call LGBT community to lessen the negative stigma associated with that practice in the minds of everyone, including black people. I think that you can't even associate HIV with homosexuality without having that community come at you in a way that, you know, would suggest that you're saying something wrong, even though that all of the indicators say that, you know, homosexuality is a vector for the HIV virus. In fact, I remember I was scrolling through my news feed and something really struck me. I saw a file photo of a black couple, which is something that I just don't see in news stories. And this news story was about HIV and the spread of HIV. And they're showing a heterosexual black couple. If you're going to depict black people, I guess you might as well just show a homosexual black couple. That would be the most logical depiction if you're going to have a representation of black people with HIV. But no, they picked a black couple. And that's probably one of the few times that I've seen a black couple being represented. So I just think that there's a lot of work being done by white supremacists to suppress any discussion of any negative side effects of engaging in homosexuality or engaging in a what they call a homosexual lifestyle. So I'll go ahead and mute my line.
Yeah, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I believe it's hesitation. So something that is interesting, because I think you even had this in your archives where you actually interviewed two homosexuals out there in Clark. I believe they did something like they was wearing heels or something at the school. And I remember you asking them, did they have any type of, what's the word?
Sexual
trauma or rape. Yeah, when they was younger. One of them admitted to it, but the other guy, if I remember correctly, hesitated and said he did no comment. So not only is hesitation in people's classified as black that's not in the lifestyle, but the ones that are actually practicing that lifestyle seems to be hesitant of what trial traumas they experienced when they was young. And speaking of on demand, I actually listened to an interview with Ron Hurd. He actually interviewed, I forgot the guy's name in front of the cover on the man, not the, the young man. I mean, the young boy that was executed.
I'm sure he interviewed him. He really? George Denny?
No, not him. His brother.
Oh, okay. Brother. Like, really?
No, I forgot his name. You know what I'm saying? His
brother. George Denny is his name. That's the young black male who was executed, George Denny.
Yeah, the black male. He interviews his brother, and I remember his brother saying as soon as that happened, his dad told the whole family they had to leave. And I thought that was very interesting as far as attempting parents to, you know, kind of think about that. But that's it. That'd be my life.
I mean, the George Stinney case, that happened in South Carolina, like decades before Emmett Till. decades before Rosa Parks, you know, refused to give up her seat on the bus, which was inspired by the lynching of Emmett Till, according to her own testimony. Decades before even the Scottsboro Boys, I'm really hitting Alabama and Mississippi, before the bus boycott. I mean, it was way early 20th century. So, I mean, absolutely, in that time, they were still castrating niggers for fun at that, and like in broad daylight, advertising it. So, yeah, it would not surprise me at all if they had to leave. I mean, you got a black, even though he was 14, you got a black child. He's been convicted, executed for raping a white girl. I think it was killing and raping a white girl. So, yeah, it would not surprise me. Like, hey, they might want to come and, you know, kill us all for that. Like, decide that killing one nigger is not good enough. You know, we got to kill the whole family for this, to avenge this white woman. So, yeah, that is the man knot. We'll be back next Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Dr. Tommy J. Curry. Anybody else want to respond to that question? Trepidation. That was great memory. They were not at Clark. They were at Morehouse, the Mean Girls of Morehouse, when they were on in 2010.
Yes, sir. Morehouse, I'm sorry.
Any other comments? Folks wanted to make sure they get in response to the question. Grant, we should be here for Workplace Racism. I already said the book club. I was thinking next Sunday would be the third Sunday in December that we'd be here for the Global Sunday Talk on Racism. However, some of our listeners in the UK were asking, or at least asked if we could perhaps do the Global Sunday Talk on Christmas Day. One of our listeners asked if we could maybe get Jeremiah Kamara back on the program for the 25th. He's been on a quote-unquote Christmas Day before in the archives, but I will ask and see if we can get him back. The Global Sunday Talk would be earlier in the day, so conceivably we could do both if he's willing to speak to us. But I'll have to see if they would be interested in moving it from Sunday to, I think it's Wednesday is the 25th. So we'll have to see. Global Sunday Talk might be next Sunday, and it might be on the 25th. We'll see what will work best for their schedule. But at minimum, we'll be here for Workplace Racism and the Book Club this coming week. If folks have commentary for Workplace Racism and or the Book Club, I will make sure I get my question in to Mr. Steele. Make sure I don't forget that. Mr. Steele, how did you conclude, or I guess what evidence did you see that made you have some suspicion about why this case was being promoted, the case that you mentioned to us earlier?
Yeah. Okay, so I'm on Twitter, and one of my profiles is it's connected to a lot of sex workers. I'll say it like that. That's the term that they use for themselves or that group. Anyway, so this, you know, I'm seeing this story being promoted by some of the more politically active ones, and the people that they're retweeting about this story are these, you know, are these suspected white supremacist white women who look like they don't, you know, have any sort of interest in sex at all, to be quite frank. And, you know, you've never heard of these people, but they have tons of followers. You know, they're just arch, what you call feminists. And they're not related to any celebrities that I would be familiar with. However, these personalities keep on saying that celebrities like this person and that person, in their articles and in the posts that they make, they say a number of celebrities are promoting this hashtag. And to me, it suggests that, this is part of some sort of political play, because if they can get this person released from prison on the basis that he killed, because he thought that he would kill her at some sort of later date, that the only time that, you know, was opportunity presented to itself to kill him was in the middle of the night while he was asleep. It, you know, if they can get her off of this, then they can basically use this case to set a precedent that any woman who feels
any bit of uncomfortable with a guy is justified at murdering them. And this is more specifically a black person, because I remember the names of the characters that they were saying that were, you know, her supposed pimp. And that was what was the initial story, was that it was her pimp that she killed. But really, it was a client that she picked up under the guise that she was a legal or she was of legal age to consent to sex. So it wasn't this some sort of it wasn't some sort of a captor scenario that they're trying to create. And then they're just, you know, the use of sex to justify murder, you know, and the murder of what I suspect is a black male. It's just, it falls right in line with all of the, with everything that we've seen behind this Me Too movement and all of the developments that we've seen surrounding it, including the lynching of Bill Cosby. So I just, you know, I honestly, I'm putting all of the context clues together, and I have, I've concluded that this is a political case that they're using specifically to justify murdering black males behind the pursuit of sex. And it's wrong to me. And I don't think that that this is a case that victims of racism should see as something that represents grave injustice, as they're putting it. Because, again, if people get life for murder all the time, murder one. I mean, this is a situation where this person planned to kill this person and then executed on the plan and then robbed them afterwards. So I just, you know, if this were a guy, there wouldn't be any sort of hashtags. There wouldn't be any sort of movement. There would only be calls that, you know, this represents justice. So I suspect that this is just a ploy by the racists to justify killing black people.
Hmm. Much obliged for the answer, Mr. Steele. Racists are selective. They can be very skillful when they choose to promote a case, when they choose to de-emphasize a case and not bring too much attention to it, frequently for racist objectives. So, suspicion warranted. Any other folks have comments they wanted to make sure they shared?
Can I be heard?
Caller in Florida?
Yes, sir. I really wanted to just make just a quick comment about the, I think it was the LGBT coming to speak out against the black male, Kevin Hart, I think that's what his name is. I thought about the, if anybody remember that story with a guy named Michael Sam, I think that was a cowbell. He recently, a couple of years after that, he came out saying that my experience from the LGBT community, it was about racism. Do you remember that, Gus? He said he was a victim, and they had a lot of issues with racism. He was being victimized.
Right. This was the football player, yes. He was with a white man and got drafted. I think he was in Missouri, yes.
Yes, sir. So that, like, I think just the hypocrisy of how the racists, they will, I think Mr. Fuller said that they use all of these kind of titles, I'm gay or I'm a feminist, but at best, white supremacists. So even with that, I think they definitely do that to mistreat and practice racism and to intimidate victims when they are still practicing racism. And they are still calling us niggers for even there was a story where they even tried to go to the so-called gay bar and they wouldn't even allow the black people who said that they were admittedly gay, and they mistreated them as well. So they still practice racism. And that's all I have to say right now. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged. I do remember that it was an to the exact point that I just made, they made a lot more, or they gave a lot more attention to Michael Sam kissing a white man on the day that he was drafted, as opposed to the article that he wrote about the racism that he experienced from white LGBTQI, any other letters that you would like to add. That didn't get nearly as much attention as when he wanted to smooch a white man on draft day. With that, unless someone has something they can report in 30 seconds or less, we pretty much did our 3 hours.
Just real quick, along with the LGBT stuff, it's real interesting how we can see regular examples of black people being persecuted for supposedly being homophobic and supposedly engaging in homosexual activity. Yet, conversely, when we see blatant examples of racism, of white supremacist behavior practiced by members of the LGBT community, there is never, I can't recall a similar incident where there was as much energy devoted to correcting the racism of an LGBT person. I can think of two specific LGBT people, a transgender person named Jeffree Star, and Milo Yiannopoulos person, engaging in racism, wanton racism, and they have never been rebuked by any sort of major LGBT outlet because of it. So,
we'll leave it there.
It's something that I've noticed.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. James Byrd Jr. and Matthew, I forgot his last name, up in my area, right up here close to Washington State and Montana and all that. But Matthew Shepard, that's it. Matthew Shepard, the young white boy that they say is a victim of all this gay hate crime, where they have a book that's written where a police officer said that that is not the case at all. Anyway. We will be back, as I said, middle of the week. Just check Black Talk Radio Network Facebook page for updates for the future broadcast. Minimum, we'll be here Thursday for Dr. Tommy J. Curry, The Man Not. We're about halfway through the text. Loving it. If you have questions. And I think that, again, that is a book we would all do better to make sure that we have the text in front of us as we go through it. I think you'll really benefit and get absorb as much as possible from what Dr. Curry has to share. With that, thanks to all who participated in the broadcast. I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Stay warm. I hope we do not have cows listeners participating in the holiday foolishness. If you got to attend a Christmas party or what have you for your job, codified and sober. On cue, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Dr. Welsing would certainly agree, and Dick Gregory, I'm sure, to take care of ourselves so that we can solve the problem of white supremacy, racism, preserve our brain computers. Certainly while we are in a vehicle, we want to be sober and buckled up. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.